Mr. Speaker. Sitting of Parliament, Thursday, 16th of February 2012. Answers to questions continue. Question 205 of 2012. The Honourable Mrs. I. M. Elul Hammond.
Mr. Speaker, can the government state when they will be initiating the arrangements to carry out a census in 2012?
Answer, the Honourable the Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, preparatory work in connection with the forthcoming census has already commenced.
Mr. Speaker, when does the Chief Minister envisage that the census will be distributed? How long will it take for it to be filled in?
Mr. Speaker, it's really not so much a question of how long it will take, but when is the best time to carry out a census. We are advised by those responsible in the Statistics Office that it's likely to be best something done in November, and therefore it's anticipated that the work will commence, the actual delivery of questionnaires will commence on Monday, the 12th of November 2012.
Question 206, the Honourable D. A. Feetham.
Are the government in a position to state when it is estimated, what is it estimated the annual cost to the taxpayer will be of the guaranteed superannuation fund?
Answer, the Honourable the Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I will answer this question together with question 207 of 2012.
Question 207.
In relation to the guaranteed superannuation fund, how will the government guarantee the value of an employee's pension?
Answer, the Honourable the Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, as already explained in answer to question 124 of 2012 yesterday, if by the cost to the taxpayer, the Honourable Member means how much will be the government's contribution as an employer, this is impossible to calculate until such time as there have been contributions made by employees on the basis of which a calculation can then be made. As has already been made public, the guaranteed superannuation fund will be invested in the Gibraltar Savings Bank, which carries a government guarantee.
Focusing on the question of the guarantee and the investment on the Gibraltar in the Gibraltar Savings Bank, is the position, and I've read the pension deed that pensioners will be asked to sign, is the position that the money will be invested in a bond whose return will be pegged on the yield, on the 25 yield of UK government gilts, or is it that the money will actually be invested in UK government gilts? What's the position?
No, Mr. Speaker, the position is that it will be invested in a bond with the Gibraltar government.
So when in the actual trust deed it says that the yields will be based on the 25-year yield for UK government gilts, it's because it's going to be pegged to that yield. Is that correct?
That is correct, Mr. Speaker.
And is he aware that this type of investment, in fact, UK government gilts, is as near as possible as you can get to cash, and therefore virtually risk-free. Is he aware of that?
Mr. Speaker, I'm aware that that is a particular view.
Well, is he aware that, for example, the returns on UK government gilts are 3.1%? And that in actual fact, that it's only ever been Of the last 20 years, it's been over 5% in 1998. That's reflecting the level of risk that this kind of investment poses.
Yes, Mr. Speaker.
Does he not think, therefore, that when the government talks about guaranteeing the fund, that that is obviously misleading because there is absolutely no risk to the underlying investment?
No, Mr. Speaker.
Am I right in saying that contributors to the Provident Pension Fund number one, number two, and number three will be able to transfer into the guaranteed superannuation fund?
Mr. Speaker, the position is that if they wish to do so, they may.
Is he aware that in relation to the Provident Fund number one, number two, and number three, there are different types of pension plans? There is income, there is growth, there is balance, and the different pension plans, the underlying investments are actually different. There are very low risk investments, there are also higher risk investments, such as investments in equities. Is he aware of that?
Yes, Mr. Speaker.
Therefore, will you not agree with me that the level of risk in terms of investments in the Provident Fund number one, number two, and number three, the type of pension plan that one is talking about, the creature, is completely and wholly different to the type of risk that one is dealing with in relation to the guaranteed superannuation fund?
Mr. Speaker, I am now aware that that is his view.
The Honourable Gentleman obviously hasn't done his homework. I mean, it's a simple answer. Yes or no? Is he aware or is he not aware? Mr. Speaker, will the Honourable the Chief Minister confirm whether anybody that is transferring into the guaranteed superannuation fund from what is a different type of investment, a different type of pension creature, will be provided advice in relation to that transfer? Or will it be on the basis of execution only?
Mr. Speaker, the position, as the Honourable Gentleman knows, I think from the answers given in this House yesterday, is that as yet there has been no applications by anyone to come into this fund.
But I'm not asking about whether there have been any application. I am asking if somebody wants to transfer from the Provident Fund number one, number two, or number three into the guaranteed superannuation fund, is that going to be on an execution basis only, or is the government going to provide some form of advice to those pensioners, to their pensioners?
Mr. Speaker, I'm not going to be answering any hypothetical questions because, in fact, there is a clear parliamentary provision that we should not. But when the time comes, we shall make a determination as to how to deal with those issues. Perhaps I should thank the Honourable Gentleman for flagging that.
Well, I did consider whether that was a hypothetical question, but I do not take the view as a hypothetical question. It's a question aimed at a policy, whether advice will be tendered or will be executed only.
Well, I'm very glad that I've been able to assist the government, but obviously I'm none the wiser as to what the government's policy is. But let me just read. He's obviously been taught very well by the Honourable Gentleman to his left. But let me read what the GSLP said in its manifesto. It said this, and I quote, "The value of the Provident Funds can go up or down and is not guaranteed." And then it went on to say that anybody could transfer into the guaranteed superannuation fund, and that because it was guaranteed, that this was an additional benefit. Will the Honourable Gentleman not accept that that is in fact a misleading statement? One, because... Well, I haven't finished.
I can tell you the answer now.
No, we've heard the answer from Mr. Lassano already. No.
When one predicates a question like that, I can tell him what the answer will be. But I'm quite happy to allow him to waste his time and his breath in expanding on his question.
Well, I... Well, because, let me explain, and then he can answer the question. Because it's absolutely right that the investments in pension plans under the Provident Fund number one, number two, and number three can go up or down. But in relation to this guaranteed superannuation fund, there is absolutely no risk with the investment going down, because the underlying investment is as near as possible as investing in cash. It's like putting the money into a bank account. In actual fact, it's even worse, because the investment is going to be in the Gibraltar Savings Bank. Unless the Gibraltar Savings Bank goes bust, then of course nobody's going to lose their money. Does the Honourable Gentleman not accept that in the light of those facts, the promises made and representations made in their manifesto were false? And does he not accept as well that in the light of those representations, it becomes even more necessary for the government to provide proper advice to its own workers and make it absolutely clear that the fact that the guaranteed superannuation fund uses the term guarantee is actually misleading?
To the first question, no. To the second question, no. To the third question, no.
Has the Honourable Gentleman received any representations from private pension providers in the private sector?
Mr. Speaker, I've spoken to a number of people in the financial services industry, some of them who are private pensions providers, about this and other matters. But this, frankly, Mr. Speaker, deviates quite a bit from the question that I'm dealing with.
Well, Mr. Speaker, if it's a point of order, I would argue the point of order. It's a valid supplementary arising from my original question.
Well, the question which I heard seemed rather wider. It didn't seem to be linked to the guarantee.
I'm talking about representations in relation to the guarantee superannuation fund. And he's understood the question.
And his answer.
Is it not the case that, in fact, private pension providers have expressed concern to the Honourable Gentleman precisely on the grounds that I have expressed concern to him today, and also in relation to competition concerns? Is it not the case?
Mr. Speaker, no, this is not the case.
Well, will the Honourable Gentleman at least give me a clear answer this afternoon?
Very clear.
And at the very least tell me what the nature of the representations about the guaranteed superannuation fund were that were made to the Chief Minister.
No, Mr. Speaker, because I don't think it's fair to tell people what it is that the representations that have been made to me in private are across the airwaves just because the Honourable Gentleman happens to be curious about it.
Curious. Well, the Honourable Gentleman is aware, because the Honourable Gentleman has sought to cloak himself with a cloak of transparency, accountability, greater consultation, and all those nice terms that the Honourable Gentleman uses on a constant basis, that he is accountable to this Parliament, that we have concerns about the guaranteed superannuation fund, that we believe that similar concerns have expressed to him. And does the Honourable Gentleman not agree with me that it is absolutely outrageous that the Honourable Gentleman refuses to answer any questions and be accountable to this Parliament on what is an important aspect of government policy affecting thousands of government workers?
Mr. Speaker, I didn't need to be elected on a manifesto that pledged accountability and transparency to know that ministers are accountable to this Parliament. Because I've spent 8 years trying to hold ministers accountable in this Parliament, and they've been much less accountable in four-year terms than we have been in the 8 weeks that we have been elected. In fact, Mr. Speaker, one thing is to be accountable, and another thing is for me to tell the Honourable Gentleman everything that happens in my meetings, some of which continue to be ongoing, and some in respect to which people are coming back to meet me to make fuller representations than they've made.
I suggest to the Honourable Gentleman that either he really doesn't know very much about the guaranteed superannuation fund, and in fact I've noticed that that before he answered my questions, the Honourable Gentleman, Mr. Bossano, was constantly whispering in his ear. It appears that although he has plucked the courage to to actually answer questions about the guaranteed superannuation fund on this occasion, because on the last occasion that I asked him, in fact, he said that he wouldn't answer because he wasn't in a position to answer, because Mr. Bassano was dealing with the position. And does he not agree with me that that is an outrageous attitude for him to adopt in this Parliament?
Well, Mr. Speaker, in answer to the first question, no. In answer to the second question, no. But let me tell him a little bit more. Mr. Speaker, I know that having left the confraternity of socialists to go to the honourable gentleman opposite and to fall into the vice of seeking power at any price, the honourable gentleman has obviously fallen out from the possibility of having what is we are enjoying as a cabinet collegiate government, where we talk to each other about the things that matter to each other, we work together on the issues, and we don't have to stand up on our own defenceless before a merciless cross-examiner who seeks only to ridicule us. That's not what government's not about, and it's not what opposition should be about either.
Mr. Speaker, I'm astounded, I have to say. But let me tell the honourable member, the honourable chief minister, that if he's going to be talking about my U-turns, let me remind him that he is at heart a liberal, that a liberal now leads the Gibraltar Socialist Labour Party, and that if I were to stand in this Parliament and say what the honourable gentleman used to say to me about the honourable Mr. Bassano, there'd be a nuclear explosion on the benches opposite, from here to Madrid.
Mr. Speaker, I've been called many worse things than a liberal before. And if I were to stand here and say to the honourable gentleman across the floor of the House, or remind him of the things he used to say about the honourable gentleman sitting to the left of him,
please don't.
Hiroshima would pale into insignificance compared to the explosion he'd be sitting next to. But given that I understand that the honourable gentleman sitting to his left used to say the same things about the honourable gentleman sitting to his right, it may be that the implosion might be such that we might learn how to split the atom. But this is question time, not science time, Mr. Speaker.
I think the last two remarks were not questions. The honourable leader of the opposition.
Mr. Speaker, the honourable chief minister can rest easy. Mr. Featum and myself kissed and made up a long time ago. politically speaking, that is. Whether the same kissing and making up is evidence in the ranks of his government, given some of the tensions that one hears already occurring within it, is another matter. Anyway, Mr. Speaker, I understand that the... I can see that the Honourable the Chief Minister is in the mood for multiple choice questions and answers today, given that he's in a yes and no mood. Well, I'll get my first supplementary then, will lend itself to that sort of treatment. Does he not agree with me that the Honourable Mr. Featum, rather than have left the confraternity of socialists, has left the confraternity of socialistas? Does he not agree with me that almost every working class representative in Gibraltar that has ever been respected by the working classes in Gibraltar have recognised that the GSD government has shown many, many, many more signs of being genuinely concerned with the interests, the social and labour interests of working people than the GSLP has ever even dreamt of showing? Does he agree with me about that?
That's why you're there, we're here.
And does he agree with me?
Order.
And does he thirdly agree with me that whilst he may be free to take the view as a matter of policy that he should not account in this House for representations made to him by third parties for fear of breaching their confidence, it is nevertheless inappropriate of him to reduce this Parliament's right and interest in the public affairs of Gibraltar to, as he accused my friend, simply being curious about it?
Mr. Speaker, that is a self-serving diatribe that is a party political broadcast and a pretext for debate, not a proper question for question time, which may account for the fact that it's taken us half an hour to get through two questions the whole of the time that the British Prime Minister would have spent on his feet in the Commons, in Parliament, answering many more. As it's a pretext for debate, as it suggests things, Mr. Speaker, that the Honourable Gentleman simply wants to raise in order to find perhaps some, or carry some more favour with headline writers tomorrow than he has been able to do to date and since the 8th of December, I'm simply going to say to him that, frankly, he should next time give me notice of that question and I'll come back with a retort that he won't enjoy.
I'll take that as a refusal to answer the question, Mr. Speaker. I don't know why he needs notice of supplementaries, each of which arise exclusively from what he has said in his last intervention. Very well, Mr. Speaker. A more constructive supplementary that the Honourable Member may be able to handle. Have I correctly understood the government to have said that it will be offering annuities?
Mr. Speaker, I think that's clear from the way that the whole of this subject has been phrased, even in the press releases.
So, if the government intends to issue annuities, can I ask the government out of what fund it will absorb any losses that might arise? I mean, the issuing of annuities is the purchase. An annuity is an annual payment for the rest of your life or for a certain number of years, purchased by the payment up front of a lump sum. That is what an annuity is. Therefore, if the government of Gibraltar is going to go into the business of writing annuities, which is the business usually of life insurance companies, you can make a profit and a loss from the activity, depending on the accuracy of the actuarial calculations of how long people are going to live. Does the government entertain the possibility, then, that the taxpayer may make losses from it conducting the business of issuer of annuities?
Mr. Speaker.
Order.
I see, Mr. Speaker,
order.
that the honourable member's opposite, conversion to socialism, includes recognizing me as the legitimate leader of socialists in Gibraltar. I welcome that. And the opposition, because the opposition have been trying to persuade the electorate that they are genuinely the working class party of Gibraltar. I don't think there's any other country in the whole of Europe, or possibly in the whole of the Western world, where the government and the opposition are competing both to be socialists. I never thought I would live to see the day. I would remind the Honourable Member that when he launched it, I mean, he, in fact, is the originator of the concept of providing government provident funds. Yes, there was no government provident funds with the possibility of an annuity until he introduced the concept in the House, and at the time, he created something which I recall that he originally said in answer to my question was going to be done through the post office. And then he told me he was going to do it outside the post office, outside the savings bank, because of the 10% that was required in addition to the money in the fund. And I think, if he doesn't remember because he's shaking his head, then I will have the question fished out and send it to him. The Honourable Member originally, when he announced it in Parliament, announced that the thing would be done through the Gibraltar Savings Bank, which is what we're doing now. And then he said that he had decided against it when at a later stage he didn't do it that way, because it meant that every time people put money into the Provident Fund would then require the Savings Bank to hold an additional 10%, which is no longer the case. And therefore, if the stage comes, which is a very long time in the future, because in fact the new superannuation fund starts on the 1st of January, there are currently nobody that is contributing to it. There may not be anybody in any of the other funds that wants to move. So far, only one person has publicly announced his intention of moving, somebody that is very familiar to the other side, who clearly doesn't share all their reservations about it.
No. No. Well, I would,
but you can advise him, of course, since he's one of yours. You can give him the advice not to do it. But the point is that when we find that there are people who switch, and when we find that there is interest in the annuity, we will revisit the arrangements that he was planning to introduce initially, which was, in fact, there was indeed a fund in the savings bank that would provide the annuities. And that is what we propose to do, go back to what he had at the beginning.
Well, Mr. Speaker, everything that the Honourable Member has just said and attributed to me about any intention or statements on my part to issue anything that looks anything like an annuity is complete and utter fabrication on his part. Mr. Speaker, the Provident scheme that we designed, will he accept, does not provide for annuities. What it provides for, he may be interested in listening to the this supplementary, what it provides for, will he not recall more carefully now, is for the pensioner's accumulated fund to be drawable on retirement in annual installments. But annual installments from his fund, not annual installments in terms of a contractual right against the government, the issuer of the gratuity. The government was concerned at the time that if somebody had accumulated £150,000 in their account, they shouldn't be able to draw it all out and blow it on a cruise and in the casino in 1 year, and then have nothing more to spend for their old age. So we introduced what he is describing, which is not an annuity, which is that they could only withdraw it in annual amounts, and that is what he is describing, which is nothing like the annuity that they have described. The annuity, as I understand it, that they have announced is that the pensioner surrenders the capital sum of his pension pot to the government, in exchange for which the government will contractually or statutorily agree to issue the person with a right to an annual income. That is an annuity, not what we intended to do. Now, whether the government makes a profit or loss on that, I would ask him to agree with me, just to convert this into a question. Would expose, whether the government makes a profit or a loss on such a transaction depends on the accuracy of the actuarial assumption made at the time that the annuity is purchased and you decide for that sum of money, I will pay you £1,000 a year, either for the rest of your life or for X years. And if it's for the rest of your life, it subsequently depends on a second variable, which is how whether the person lives longer or less. If he lives less, the annuity issuer makes a profit. If the person lives longer, then the annuity issuer makes a loss. And I am asking the Honourable Member to simply recognise that issuing annuities in that way exposes the government, if the government is to issue it, both to the possibility of making profit and to the risk of making loss. Does he agree?
I agree, Mr. Speaker, that those possibilities exist. All I am saying to him is that before he introduce the scheme that is, he doesn't have to hide, I'm not going to be nasty to him.
I'm afraid we're going to turn off my phone.
Yes.
But anyway, my protege is missing in my
place. Yes. Well,
oh,
sorry. I think.
But no kissing, please.
I think if that is what the Honourable Member is relying on, I suggest he comes along with a bulletproof vest. Can I tell the Honourable Member that before he moved to the system of telling people that they had the option of reducing their capital base by making withdrawals, the first proposal was an annuity. And I will prove it to him. I will prove it to him. I will be able to fish it because I remember it. You see, he may not, but I do. The second thing is that if, when the time comes, which is probably a very long time in the future, that the first persons will be retiring from the having contributed to the guaranteed superannuation fund. When that happens, and a decision then is taken, and people are being given either an annuity or a lump sum, which they will be able to choose because the decision will only be made when you reach retirement, the plan at present is that that should be done through a fund that would be part of a savings bank. But, you know, clearly, I think that before that happens, there will be many elections and many changes of government, and another government may have a different policy. But that would be the plan now, if it was happening now.
So any losses that might accumulate in this annuity, in this annuity selling scheme, will be the problem of some future government, and the honourable members appear to be consoled by that fact.
Well, no, since I am telling the honourable member that there is not yet one single contributor to the system, and that the date when the first payments have to be made is in the future, if at that time he or somebody that thinks like him is in government, they can decide not to proceed down that route and not provide it. I have no doubt that this can be done, and that it can be done at zero loss. But I'm not going to explain to him how it's done. He doesn't know to do it. We'll do it if we're there. It won't happen if we're not.
If the honourable member believes, surely, that annuity writing business can be done with a guarantee of no loss, he has lost his vocation. He could have made himself a multi-billionaire in the City of London, explaining to insurance companies how it is possible to go into the business of selling annuities with no risk whatsoever of loss. I mean, the honourable member may think that he can just make glib statements in this House and get away with them. But no one in the history of mankind has yet devised a way of selling annuities with a guarantee that it cannot result in a loss to the person who, in exchange for a fixed lump sum of money at the beginning, has to pay an annual amount for an indeterminate number of years, which may or may not exceed the amount that he received in the front end plus financing costs. And the honourable member thinks that he can get out of every inappropriate policy that he announces in this House simply by saying that there aren't any clients yet, and that when there is a client, I'll have to wait until I'm 156 to find out whether he was clever enough to invent a system that exposes the taxpayer to loss. Everybody will know that if the government of Gibraltar competes with insurance companies in the selling of annuities, then the government of Gibraltar can make a loss on that business as easily and as much as the commercial companies can do. Will you not acknowledge at least the possibility of that? I acknowledge the possibility that the government could make a profit from it. All I'm asking him to acknowledge in return, that if you have the possibility of making a profit, you have the possibility of making a loss as well.
Let me just remind the honourable member that yesterday he didn't know how it was going to be possible to provide 100% commutation to existing civil service pensioners.
At no cost to the government.
That is correct.
That's what you said.
Yep, that is correct. And therefore, he clearly didn't know how to do it in government, because when I asked him to do it, he told me from this side of the House it was impossible.
It's not possible.
Yeah. And you still believe it's not possible. And therefore, you will believe it when it happens. And since this is not going to happen for a very long time... Well, no, Mr. Speaker, I am afraid...
Order.
No. The honourable member is asking questions about a policy. I've told him what the policy is. I've told him that it is a policy that is unlikely to be required to be activated within the term of office of this government. It is a policy that will happen with this government or a successor government that carries on with that same policy. If there is a different government in future, when there is the first contributor due to take his money, and that government at that time, in 10 years, 20 years or 30 years' time, decides that they don't know how to provide an annuity fund through the savings bank, which can in fact match its exposure with an alternating asset, that will guarantee no loss, then that's the problem of the government at that time. I can tell him, we know how it can be done, and that we could do it tomorrow if there was a need to do it tomorrow. But there is no need to do it tomorrow, and there is no need to explain it.
Why does the honourable member believe that this won't arise in the first term of office, in this term of office? Look, Mr. Speaker, the honourable member has said that the Providence scheme is open to the private sector, that you can change, transfer from the Providence scheme to the superannuation fund, that the superannuation fund will be available also to existing civil servants who will be able to get full commutation. How does he know that sometime in the next few months, a civil servant who retires and commutes the entirety of his pension is not going to knock on his door and say, now keep to your promise and sell me an annuity?
The reality of that is that it would take a very ignorant civil servant to do that. And I can only suppose that the level of economic ignorance of that civil servant must be matched by the level of economic ignorance of the questioner if he suggests that that is conceivably possible for anybody, that they should have a civil service final salary scheme, that they should convert that into a lump sum and then use a lump sum to buy an annuity which would give them a lower income than they had in the first place.
It may not be a lower income.
Yes, it will be a lower income. There's no question. Why? I'll tell him why. Because the commutation is based on 8%. That's why. And you cannot get that return. So you are selling something at 8% and then buying it back at 7 or 6 and you make a loss.
So
that what he say, if anybody came along with that idea, the advice that he would get was that the annuity that we would be able to offer him would be less than the pension he had just sacrificed. Secondly, I have not said that the guaranteed superannuation fund is for civil servants who go for 100% commutation. I am saying that the guaranteed superannuation fund is for the people who no longer have a final salary pension because he thought it was necessary to bring it to an end because it would be a millstone around the necks of future generations. And what we've done is we've produced a smaller millstone around the necks of future generations by the guaranteed superannuation fund, which until a few days ago was being condemned as being something that was so exposed that it would ruin the government, and today is being condemned as being misleading because it's so safe that it's almost cash. So it's quite obvious that if they think there is a risk, they exaggerate the risk in order to attack what we're doing, and if they think there is no risk, they attack that there is no risk so as to tell us we're misleading people and saying we're guaranteeing something that is self-evidently guaranteed. Well, if it is self-evidently guaranteed, then all that criticism until now have been wrong. And I can tell the Honourable Member that the reason why I am saying it is not going to happen in the next 3 years is because if somebody was close enough to retirement to join the superannuation fund tomorrow, after 3 years' contributions, the amount that he could buy in terms of an annuity would be so little that nobody would do it. He must remember that the first step that was taken by the government in giving people the lump sum from the Provident Fund was on the basis that the amount of money that had been accumulated in the Provident Fund was so small that to force people to take an annuity or to take an income stream was wrong, and that they should be able to take all their money out. That is how he started moving in the direction of letting people take everything out when the government first started the process of removing the requirement for the 25% maximum amount that could be withdrawn. And the argument then, quite rightly, was, look, you're saying to people they've got to buy an annuity with a 75%, and nobody will sell them an annuity because what they've got is only a couple of £1,000 saved up. Well, that is all that would be happening in the next few years from new entrants. I don't believe there's going to be a rush of people wanting to switch from one to the other anyway. It's just something that we've put there as a possibility for those who are interested. If there is anybody in the private sector that wants to use this as a vehicle for the future, for his retirement, on the basis that what is available in the market carries the risk that he puts the money there and loses it, then that is all that we're offering. We're offering people something that is more secure, but more secure with the kind of return that you get on 25-year gilts. Not, you know, what people can't expect is to have a high-risk return on a zero-risk investment.
Which, what the manifesto appears to indicate.
Well, it appeared to indicate it to you.
And to everybody else.
Yes. No, 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 well, no, Mr. Speaker, no, if the Honourable Member thought that that is what it indicated, he first of all invents what the manifesto says, then he criticises it because it isn't what we're doing, then he accuses us of doing a U-turn because we are not doing what he invented. Well, look, I'm afraid he can keep on doing that for as long as he wants, but it won't get him anywhere. The superannuation fund that we're offering is considered to be an improvement on what is there today by many people. But we're doing more than that. We are saying to people in the public service, you've got the choice of staying with the Provident Fund as it has been until now. You've got a second choice of opting for the improvements that the GSD offered in their manifesto and we're committed to introducing. And thirdly, you've got the choice of going for what we have put. Now, what are we being accused of doing? Not giving people enough advice as to which of the three they should choose. Well, look, we're doing more than anybody else has done before. We're doing something that we happen to think is better, but nobody's being forced to take it. They can either stay with what they would have had if the GSD had won the election, or they can stay with what they used to have until 2011, or they can take what is new in 2012. And they still have to find fault with it. Well, I can tell the Honourable Member that he can rest assured that this can be done, that it will not ruin Gibraltar, and that it will not create massive losses for the savings bank. And that if he doesn't know how it can be done, well, then I'm afraid I am not here, nor any of us are here, in order to give him lessons in economic theory or in anything else. I can tell him that I don't believe I could have made the million in advising insurance companies because of what I've said today, but even if I could, I would not have chosen to do that, because when I chose to come back in 1972 to serve the people of Gibraltar, it was not because there were more millions to be made here than in London, but because it was what I wanted to do with my life.
I was wondering when he was going to deliver his valedictory speech. What I didn't imagine was that it would be an answer to a supplementary question in Parliament. Now, Mr. Speaker, will the Honourable Member just tell me whether he has said that the superannuation fund will be available to the private sector, to employees of private sector companies?
Mr. Speaker, it was not my valedictory speech because I've got 19 years left.
order.
What I announced when we launched this fund, which is a fund that is under the Gibraltar Development Corporation, like the other Provident funds are, is that it will be open without a contribution from the government, clearly, to any employer that wants to join this instead of joining the number 3 Provident Fund, which is the one that was set up by the previous administration for the private sector, or to an individual who is self-employed and wants to provide for himself, or indeed to an employee that wants to have a secure vehicle to provide for his own retirement in an area where the employer doesn't do it. So effectively there are 3 categories of people in the private sector who, if they wish, can in fact become members of the guaranteed superannuation fund and contribute. But the value will be the value of what they put in plus the reinvested accumulated interest.
Yes, would have been sufficient. And therefore, any of the persons that he has listed could transfer into the scheme the accumulated value, capital value, in his present pension arrangement by way of transfer. Yes or no?
I can't say a categorical yes or no to that. Because
it is
Because, in fact, I think it depends not just on our willingness to receive the money. I mean, the...
Assuming his willingness.
Well, I was going to say, it doesn't just depend on that. I haven't said we are willing to do it. I've just said it doesn't just depend on that, but it must also depend on what are the rules in the alternative where the money is now. But, in fact, the scheme as it is set up now doesn't, I think, I don't think as it is structured now, it may be we may need to amend it to do that. But I think as it is structured now, it doesn't actually specify that you can make lump sum payments irrespective of the amount, because what we're talking about is making regular contributions on a monthly basis. So I'm not 100% sure that somebody can say, well, look, I am going to withdraw the money that I've got in another pension fund and arrive with £500,000 and put it into that. But certainly it's something we're willing to consider if somebody comes along with that proposal. But I'm not 100% sure that the rules that, as they are now, include that possibility. It includes the possibility of somebody joining as from a current date at the moment as it stands.
Doesn't he understand that if somebody can transfer into the scheme with a lump sum, he is then in a position, if such a person were approaching retirement age, he is then in a position, unlike the civil servant who is unlikely to happen because in the next 3 years it's not going to happen during this term because no one's going to have accumulated. Such a person as we are now discussing could transfer a lump sum from an existing scheme into the superannuation fund, retire in 2 years' time, and come knocking at his door before the next election, therefore, and ask him to sell him an annuity. And all the diatribe that he gave me before would not apply to such a person.
Well, I imagine that that is a list of hypothetical possibilities.
Right?
Yes.
This is a new word that they've discovered.
Well, Mr. Speaker, he say, do I not agree that it is possible that A will happen, and then that B will happen, and that C will happen? Yes. It is also possible that Iran may have a nuclear bomb and attack Israel. Yes. That is also possible. In yes. which case, nothing is safe yes. anymore.
Or not is hypothetical.
I'm not
the possibility that it can happen is not hypothetical, it's real.
Order. The Honourable Minister is answering, even though he has prefaced the answer with hypothetical, I believe he's willing yeah. to...
So I am saying that the fact that any of those things may happen or may not happen is a hypothetical question, but I'll tell him what the answer is. If it happens, which I don't think it will, but if it happens, we'll provide the annuity from the savings bank for that one or two or three people that decide to do it. And I can assure you, the Honourable Member, that we will do it in a way which guarantees that we will not lose money on it. But I don't think we will have the opportunity of demonstrating to him that he doesn't know what he's talking about, because regrettably, all those hypothetical situations I don't think will materialise. So I would welcome if somebody comes and does it so that we can show him that he doesn't know what he's talking about.
Before the Honourable Member stands up, I have allowed over half an hour discussion on this particular topic.
Beg your pardon?
But on the same topic, can't be a new topic.
We've already established what we wanted to establish on the annuity.
Thank you. Now, I was just going to suggest something that I will allow one more supplementary in the hope of bringing this whole discussion to an end. It's open to the Honourable Member to debate the matter on a separate motion whenever. I'm told by the Chief Minister he'll make time available to this Parliament as often as required.
That's very generous of him indeed. Mr. Speaker, did I correctly understand the Chief Minister to say that these superannuation funds would invest in Gibraltar government debentures? In Gibraltar government bonds and debentures?
No, Mr. Speaker, I didn't. I'm just checking. I didn't say that. I said it would invest in a Gibraltar government bond, not in a debenture.
Well, I don't know what he thinks the difference is between a bond and a debenture, but anyway, leaving that point just to one side for a moment. So this will constitute
the sale of public debt, in other words, the same way as government debentures is now. Does the honourable member not agree? Does the honourable member not agree? But don't worry, I'm not questioning him about the level of public debts, about which I'm not as concerned as he is. Does the honourable member not agree that the effect of people getting what is in effect their pension fund and using it to buy government bonds, which is in effect government borrowing instruments, which the government can then spend, is tantamount to the government spending people's pension pots?
I think the honourable member...
Yes or no?
Demonstrate... No, I'll tell him. The answer is no, because every time he asks a new question, he increases the exposure of his level of ignorance of the subject. What is he now saying? That for the first time, the £300 million deposited in the government savings bank is now public debt. Is that what he's telling the House?
No.
Then, in fact...
That is not what I've said, nor is it what he said.
Order.
Then I have to tell him the contributions to the superannuation fund will be in the fund created under the same rules as the existing Provident Fund. If he reads the audited accounts... No.
On a point of order. Mr. Speaker, yeah. When they rise and say point of order, it is a license for them to say what they do, eventually. Mr. Speaker, that would be a clarification of what they said before, upon which I based my last supplementary, but it is not what they said before. When I asked the member whether the superannuation fund would be invested in a government savings bond, debenture, he said, no, not bond, not debenture, bond. In other words, the superannuation fund directly buying government bonds. That's what he sold me, and that's what justified my supplementary. If he is now saying that the superannuation fund would invest in the Gibraltar Savings Bank, and that the Gibraltar Savings Bank will then buy government bonds, that is a wholly different transaction to the one that was given information that was given to me in the previous last supplementary but one, and would not have attracted my last supplementary. It's nothing to do with ignorance, it's about the accuracy of the information that they give me in answer to questions.
The accuracy of the information given is that in the previous answers that had been given to question, it was made clear that the honourable member was told the reason why the fund is guaranteed is because the fund will invest the money in the savings bank. That is in the original answer.
I asked whether the superannuation fund was invested in Gibraltar government debentures, and the answer was yes. The answer should have been no, it will be
invested in Gibraltar Savings Bank debentures or bonds. That would have been an answer which would not have invited my subsequent supplementary. But when I asked, I was told that they were investing directly in government debt, Gibraltar government bonds.
No, the answer is yes. No. The answer is, if the answer that we've given misled the Honourable Member...
The answer is,
as stated originally in the original answer to the question, the fund will invest only in the savings bank. And that is why the fund is able to say to people the money that we're investing is, in fact, guaranteed because the savings bank is guaranteed by the government.
I really must invite the Leader of Opposition to take up my offer to bring a motion if you wish to debate the matter further. We move to the next question.
Question 208, the Honourable D.A. Feetham.
When does the government envisage that parliamentary sessions will be televised by GBC?
Answer, the Honourable the Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, the intention of the government is to provide a live stream of proceedings on a dedicated website of this parliament. That live stream will also be made available to GBC or to any other interested party. The government IT department have already started working on the specification of the cameras and systems required in order to facilitate the webcasting of the work of this parliament.
The original question referred to being televised by GBC. Is it the intention at some stage for proceedings of parliament to be televised by GBC with cameras here in the House?
Mr. Speaker, I think I've made very clear what the answer to that question is. In other words, that there will be cameras here and that the feed from these cameras will be made available to GBC. That would cause what is happening here to be broadcast by GBC.
But I understood the answer, and I'm not trying to be controversial, I just want to understand the answer. I understood that it's going to be broadcast via the internet. Is it going to be also broadcast via conventional GBC broadcasting?
Speaker, I think the best way to deal with that question is to explain to the honourable gentleman what happens in other parliaments. In other parliaments, the parliament itself films its proceedings and makes available the feed to such broadcasters as may wish it. In the United Kingdom, there is a channel that broadcasts what happens in the UK in the House of Commons, but not just in the Commons, also what happens in some of the debating chambers, what happens in the upper house, etc. The feed is made available to the BBC by the Parliament. It is our intention that the Parliament should have control of its cameras and make the feed available. The Honourable Gentleman will know that there is more than one entity now seeking to broadcast. There are some entities online that want to broadcast news, for example. The feed will be made available to everyone, and anyone, whether a broadcaster or otherwise, who is sitting at their desk at work and is minded not just to listen to the proceedings on radio, but to watch us, they might think that there are some handsome devils in this house or beautiful ladies that they might like to see and not just listen to. Well, Mr. Speaker, they'll be able to see them on our website as well as that night on television if a broadcaster decides to extract some part of the proceedings for the news. Or, of course, one of the broadcasters could also make available on their channel what is being put out on the internet if they so wished.
What type of timescale are we talking about?
Mr. Speaker, the first time I talked about televising the proceedings of this Parliament was in 2003 when I was first elected. So therefore, to the Honourable Gentleman, I will say that it's my intention that this should happen as soon as possible. I know that already the IT department are working very hard on this. I know that there are some planned visits as early as next week by experts who have fitted the type of hardware required in other parliaments, and it may be that therefore, you know, hopefully before the summer, we will have the systems in place to allow that. But, Mr. Speaker, subject to this caveat, I don't think it's within the gift of the government to simply say that this should happen. This exploratory work is going on the basis of cooperation with your parliament, but we would have to, I think, have a motion of this House before we can actually press the button to televise and allow a camera in here.
Mr. Speaker, as I've understood the Honourable Member, what he has explained is that there will be the filming for, you just use a layman's term, the filming by parliamentary equipment, that will initially be put out on internet, and then the feed will be provided to any other broadcaster such as may want to broadcast it by any other medium, television for example. But my supplementary is this. The Honourable Member is aware that the quality of the broadcasting, the quality of the transmission, the quality of the equipment required for internet transmission differs significantly, or may differ significantly, from that required for the production of a signal which is of sufficiently high quality to be broadcastable by analog or digital television. Will the Honourable Member agree that if that is the case, that the equipment and the systems in place will be such as to produce both, signal and broadcast of a standard both sufficient for the internet, but also sufficient, if different, for broadcasting on analog or digital television?
Mr. Speaker, I don't agree with him for technical reasons, but I think we're both wanting to go in the same direction. I think that there are now cameras of the sort that are used for internet broadcasting, which are of the same quality, and it's high definition quality, HD quality, as the cameras that would be used for television broadcasting. The difficulty in getting the quality, Mr. Speaker, is very often in the transmission. So in other words, when it goes down the internet, there is a lot of quality loss. But our view is that it's possible to give broadcasters, in other words, people who don't want to watch it on the internet, broadcasters who want to produce television news programs or live television feeds, a feed before the internet, so that therefore if there is any quality loss as a result of the internet here, it is not going to be suffered when people watch the video of it at home, because the HD cameras that we are intending to use, or believe it is possible to use, will be of the quality required for television, whether that television is IP television, or whether it's broadcast television, digitally broadcast or analog broadcast television. And the Honourable Gentleman, I think, will understand my example in this sense. It is possible to watch Prime Minister's Question Time in the United Kingdom on the Downing Street website, but you get there internet quality video. At the same time, simultaneously, it is possible to watch it on the BBC Parliament channel and some of the other news channels that consider that an event that should be broadcast. That is high quality, transmission quality video. And that is what we anticipate providing, those two types of feed.
And will this be run by the government IT department, or is the government proposing to go out to tender for this to be run by a company in the private sector?
Well, Mr. Speaker, very much depends on what the anticipated cost may be once we've had an indication of how much hardware is going to be required. It may be that there is a procurement process for third parties to provide and install the equipment, but that maintenance is then something that can be done by the government's in-house IT department. So it may be a combination of both of those.
Question 209, the Honourable D.A. Feetham.
Can the Chief Minister confirm whether the government will be making premises available for GBC for relocation?
Answer the Honourable the Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I will answer this question together with question 222.
Question 222.
Have the government yet decided on the best way to proceed in the light of the King report into GBC?
Answer the Honourable the Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, in relation to question 209, yes, Mr. Speaker. And in relation to question 222, the government had asked that GBC progress the appointment of a CEO designate. As a result, interviews were held and Mr. Gerard Duma was appointed, and these were the things, the principal issue for us, Mr. Speaker, as a result of the King report. We are progressing the move to digital as a matter of urgency, because this was so delayed by the previous administration that it is now very urgent indeed.
Mr. Speaker, the King report, I think the Honourable Member will agree, the King report speaks about more than just premises and the need to appoint a permanent CEO. It's about the whole change in the culture and a whole series of restructures and things of that sort, programming. Does the Honourable Member, has the government decided whether it wishes to pursue any of the aspects of the King report beyond the ones that he's touched on, premises, switch to digital, and appointment of a permanent CEO, which is not even a quarter of the King report.
Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Gentleman is right, that is not even a quarter of the King report, but he will also agree with me, I have no doubt, that they were some of the most fundamental issues that did arise from the King report. In other words, the need to move out of premises that are no longer fit for purpose, and I think that across the floor of the House we would agree with that finding of Mr. King, the need to have a proper management structure in respect to which the appointment of a CEO designate, given that Mr. King's own appointment expires next year, was also a very important matter. And of course, Mr. Speaker, all of this pivots around the fact that there needs to be the capacity to broadcast. Otherwise, there can be no Gibraltar Broadcasting Corporation. And Mr. Speaker, as the Honourable Gentleman knows, the most urgent thing now is the move to digital. Because if GBC is not digital by the 31st of December, it will not be able to broadcast at all. There will be an analogue switch-off at midnight on the 31st of December, because that is now required by the EU and by various international agreements to which Gibraltar is a party. Those, therefore, Mr. Speaker, are for us the most important aspects of progressing the King report. It is true, Mr. Speaker, to say that there are other aspects of the King report which we are considering with Mr. King himself, who is still with us, and with the management of GBC in order to ensure that we deliver the best broadcasting that we believe is available to our community.
Speaker, with
the Honourable Member agree with me? I mean, I will agree with him that the, certainly the switch to digital has now become urgent and was always going to be a priority in 2012. Will the Honourable Member agree with me that it is simply too simplistic a view to think that if GBC had always had a digital broadcasting and had always had a CEO and had always had spanking premises, it would not suffer from any of the issues that the King Report thinks need attention to? In other words, does he agree that whilst I don't say it's illegitimate for him to start with those three issues, that those are not, however important they may be, and indeed however time urgent some of them may be, they are not what is fundamental about what needs to be rejigged and restructured in GBC, that it actually goes much more deeper, very often into non-tangible things?
Mr. Speaker, I know that the Honourable Gentleman will not want to agree with me when I tell him that, in fact, a lot of the things that he's talked about have become urgent. Going digital when zero investment almost has been made to date in 11 months is going to be a very hard slog indeed, but I'm sure that we will make it with the goodwill and the investment that is required, not just from the professionals at GBC, but also from the regulatory authority. Not having had a CEO, Mr. Speaker, or even a general manager, since the last general manager retired, in fact, retired many years ago, before the 2007 election, the Honourable Gentleman will know, is an issue that he and I have disagreed about since the date of that retirement, when I was asking him, as shadow member for broadcasting, and he's then Minister for Broadcasting, to go down the route of appointing a general manager, and he took this community through a general election with no general manager of GBC and a rotating headship. But of course, Mr. Speaker, it is true that there are other problems at GBC other than just going digital and the appointment of a CEO designate. Of course it is the case. That is the case in every organisation, Mr. Speaker. But I'm very confident that the good people of GBC, the fantastic professionals that we have up there, will be able, with the right backing from this government and the right level of investment, to produce the broadcasting that this community deserves in the second decade of the 21st century.
Question 210, the Honourable D.A. Feetham.
Will the Chief Minister confirm that the first session of his proposed system of direct democracy will commence this month?
Answer, the Honourable the Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, yes, sir.
Can the Honourable the Chief Minister state what form this system of direct democracy will take?
Not at this moment, Mr. Speaker, because there are different forms that it will take in different quarters in order to ensure that it is as accessible as possible to the different people who may be interested in accessing us directly. For example, it may be that there are some social media sessions which enable people to put questions through social media and for the government to answer those questions through social media. It may be that there is a more traditional sort of session where the Chief Minister appears on television to answer questions from a live audience or from telephone calls. But all of that, of course, will require GBC to be involved or any other broadcaster that may be interested in carrying it. Mr. Speaker, it is very likely that one of the options for the first quarter will have been chosen and announced by the end of next week. It's very likely, Mr. Speaker, that we will choose to change the option that we go for each quarter so that different people who feel more comfortable with different sorts of media will find it easier to access us in each quarter.
Speaker, does the Honourable Member agree, would he agree with me, that to the extent that he uses GBC as a platform for what he calls direct democracy, that GBC would have an obligation under their charter and statute to balance that with equivalent or commensurate facilities to the other side of this House?
Mr. Speaker, I'm very happy to consider that with the Honourable Gentleman if he wishes, but of course he is... But of course, Mr. Speaker, he is as able to open himself up to questions on Twitter or on Facebook as I am, without engaging GBC and its obligations, but it is an issue that would have to be considered in respect of any aspect of direct democracy that is carried on the national broadcaster that is a statutory body.
Question 211, the Honourable D.A. Feetham.
Is the government supportive of the attempts by GSLP activists to form a new union in Gibraltar?
Answer, the Honourable the Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, the government respects the right and freedom of association of workers, and our policy is to positively engage with all trade unions that exist in Gibraltar. It is not the policy of the government to discourage or support the formation of new unions. Freedom of association and the freedom to form unions are fundamental rights.
Is he aware that, in fact, the main movers, the ringleaders in relation to this particular union are GSLP members and at least one GSLP executive member? And is he not aware that GSLP headquarters is also used for the same purpose?
Mr. Speaker, I don't recognise any of the pejorative things that the Honourable Gentleman is suggesting, but I do have, Mr. Speaker, my own personal union card, which still says TNG, and it's a Unite card.
There's nothing pejorative in the question, but does he not accept, Mr.
Ringleader,
Speaker?
The word ringleader was pejorative.
Does he not accept?
The word ringleader only applies to someone who's engaged in an activity which is distasteful or at the very least.
Well, I have to say that was not my understanding of the term ringleader.
Well,
but
if it wasn't intended, then it's understood.
But in any event, does he not accept that, in fact, if he wanted to, he could put a stop to it by instructing his colleagues within the GSLP executive to actually put a stop to the attempt to create a new union? And is it not the case that this is an attempt, in fact, to undermine Unite and its leadership?
Mr. Speaker, first of all, I don't come from a political party where we tell people what to do. Second, the freedom to associate and the right to establish unions, as far as I'm concerned, is so fundamental that I will never be involved in telling people what they should or should not do. But, Mr. Speaker, frankly, to put all that into a parcel and present it as an attempt to undermine Unite really is just the Honourable Gentleman trying to imagine himself into a better political advantage than the one he is in. The fact is, Mr. Speaker, that I enjoy excellent relationships with all the trade unions in Gibraltar, with Unite, with the Taxi Association, with the GGCA, and with the Teachers Association. And I should stop there, Mr. Speaker, and congratulate the Teachers Association for having achieved today 50 years of representation of those teachers in our schools. Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Gentleman will be very disappointed to know that I had dinner last night with Kevin Coyne from Unite the Union. He came to visit me this morning in my office.
Did you apologise? Well, Mr. Speaker, no doubt the Honourable Gentleman says that he has excellent relations with Unite and with its leadership. From answers to questions yesterday by the Honourable Member to his left, your position is completely in contrast with the position of the Honourable Member, Mr. Bossano. But is there a division in the government in relation to this particular issue and in relation to the position that you as Chief Minister are taking and the position that the Honourable Member, Mr. Bossano, the more aggressive position that the Honourable Member, Mr. Bossano, is taking in relation to sponsorship of this new union?
Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Gentleman wants to misinterpret everything he is told. I was delighted to listen to the debate yesterday after I left, and all I heard was that the Honourable Mr. Bossano was very rightly stating that he's not the minister with responsibility for industrial relations that I am, and that therefore I see unions when they want to negotiate directly with the government. The Honourable Gentleman wants to see division where there is none because it is in his political interest that there should exist division. He wishes we were divided, Mr. Speaker. He wishes we were acting against one union in order to favour another so that he could sow his seed of dissent and make it grow so that it might elevate him into the post that he so covets. It's just not there, Mr. Speaker.
Speaker, does he think that it's appropriate for the former leader of the opposition, Mr. Bossano, to actually say that the leadership of Unite couldn't spell the term or the word duress? Does he think that's appropriate? And does he not agree with me that that is indicative of the hostility that Mr. Bossano feels towards the leadership of Unite?
Mr. Well, Mr. Speaker, I think that we say a lot of things across the floor of this House in jest and in the heat of the parliamentary moment. But I must say that Mr. Speaker, that of course Mr. Bosana must have been absolutely right, given that the post of leadership of Unite at the moment is vacant, as he knows, and there's nobody there.
Did you discuss the leadership of Unite yesterday with Mr. Coyne at the dinner?
Mr. Speaker, I had a fantastic dinner last night with Mr. Coyne. We discussed many things, none of which I'm going to refer to the Honourable Gentleman. And I discussed them, Mr. Speaker, with Mr. Coyne as a member of the union that he represents and as Chief Minister of Gibraltar. And I must tell him that we had a fantastic dinner, and however hard he tries to sow that seed of dissent, it's just not going to take, Mr. Speaker. The soil ain't fertile for this.
Well, Mr. Speaker, I didn't ask the Honourable Gentleman as to whether the swordfish that he had last night tasted good or not. I mean, I've asked him whether he's discussed the issue of the leadership of Unite. Yes or no? And may I ask another supplementary question linked to this? Has he, on any previous occasion, written or spoken to Mr. Coyne or the UK Unite about the leadership of Unite in Gibraltar?
Mr. Speaker, I am not going to tell the Honourable Gentleman what I discuss over dinner with people. I just don't think that I'm accountable. But I will say this, I didn't have swordfish, and I shouldn't be telling the Honourable Gentleman because my wife thinks I'm on a diet and I am having fish, but I had beef. I will say this, Mr. Speaker, In my capacity as Chief Minister of Gibraltar, and in any other capacity, I have not written to anyone about the leadership of Unite. I hope that gives the Honourable Gentleman the satisfaction that he's obviously looking for.
What about in a previous incarnation?
I don't think that needs answering. It's not a question. Next question.
Question 212, the Honourable P.R. Caruana.
Mr. Speaker, can the Chief Minister say what is the overall government revenue and expenditure in the current financial year as at the 31st of January 2012?
Answer the Honourable the Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I will answer this question together with questions 213 to 217.
Question 213.
Mr. Speaker, can the Chief Minister say whether any payments have yet been made from the consolidated fund to the statutory benefits fund pursuant to his public statement of the 18th of January 2012?
Question 214.
14 or 17, did you say?
214.
17. 14 and 17? Oh, I see. Can the Chief Minister say what is the total amount of payments that have been made from the consolidated fund to any special fund, government-owned company or statutory corporation since the 9th of December 2011, giving the total amount for each? Can the Chief Minister give a breakdown as at the 31st of January 2012 of aggregate public debt by bank loans and bank and each different issue of government debenture? Will the Chief Minister say what were the aggregate public debt and the government cash reserves as of the 31st of January 2012? And last but not least, will the Chief Minister say how much by nominal value has been issued in debentures or other debt security by the Gibraltar Savings Bank since the 9th of December 2011, giving a breakdown in respect of each such issue?
Answer the Honourable the Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, tentative overall revenue in the current financial year to the 31st of January 2012 stood at 351.6 million, and the tentative overall expenditure stood at 318.7 million. No payments have yet been made from the Consolidated Fund to the Statutory Benefits Fund. No payments have been made to any of the special funds since the 9th of December that were not already approved by Parliament in the estimates and the budget debates. If any payments above those set out in the budget are required, these will be provided for in a supplementary appropriation bill. We will not be providing a breakdown by month, as that is just a snapshot of the internal accounts of the government, which will be constantly changing. At the end of the financial year, in less than 6 weeks, the member opposite will see the portion reflected in the estimates. The position reflected in the estimates. In respect of advances to government companies, a further £1 million has been advanced since the 8th of December when he left office. In respect of question 215, Mr. Speaker, I will hand the Honourable Gentleman a statement with the information requested in a moment. Mr. Speaker, as at the 31st January 2012, the aggregate public debt stood at 524.6 4.4 million. The cash reserves on that date stood at 224.5 million. I hand the Honourable Gentleman a statement with the information requested in question 217.
Mr. Speaker, did I correctly interpret the Honourable Member's statement of the 18th of January 2012 to mean that the government intends, before the close of this financial year, to make a payment from the Consolidated Fund into the Statutory Benefits Fund equivalent to the shortfall in revenue over expenditure in the Statutory Benefits Funds, not just in this current financial year, but in respect of previous financial years as well?
Mr. Speaker, what I've said, and I think I said it also in the statement that I made to the nation on the 18th of January, was that it was going to be, in fact, a further 2.5 million that was going to be required. So a total of 10 million will be contributed this year instead of 7.5 million.
To meet this year's.
To meet this year's shortfall.
So when he said in his statement about an adjustment in respect of previous years, that is not the intention behind whatever that statement may have meant, was not that in this financial year the Consolidated Fund would be charged with previous year's shortfall in inverted commas.
No, Mr. Speaker, it was that we were going to be making provision as from this year, what we consider to be adequate provision as from this year, and there would be a note below the line in respect of what was required in other years.
But his statement, does he not recall, treated separately what was required in their view for this year, and then went on to say, and we will be restating, we'll be providing an amount in respect of the alleged shortfall, there was a shortfall of revenue over expenditure in previous years. That is what he said, and I'm just trying to, the obvious meaning of the words, unless they mean something other than the obvious, is that they were going to make a one-off provision in respect of past year's alleged shortfalls in addition to this year's.
Mr. Speaker, I think that he's confusing what I said in respect of companies and what I said in respect of the Statutory Benefits Fund. I'm quite happy to read him what I said in respect of the Statutory Benefits Fund so that it's clear. I said this, Mr. Speaker. The figures presented by Mr. Caruana to the Parliament, I say Mr. Caruana instead of the Honourable Gentleman because that's what I said in my statement, in the estimates did not reflect this as part of the government's own recurrent spending. Neither does this take into account the reduction in the reserves of the Statutory Benefits Fund from which we pay old age pensions, in respect of which we will have to increase the provision from 7.5 million by a further 2.5 million required to keep the fund at the same level at which it was at the beginning of the year. That will further reduce the surplus. That's all I said. That's all I said. Mr. Speaker, then I said, the surplus for the current year will therefore be recalculated to give you a true and fully accurate picture by including the recurrent losses of government companies and by reflecting the additional funding required by the Statutory Benefits Fund.
So, when he lumped that last reference to Statutory Benefits Fund, the last words that he has uttered, he lumps them with a reference to company balances, both in respect of previous years, leading me to believe that both related to previous year's shortfalls.
No, Mr. Speaker, I think my statement is very clear. He has had an opportunity to reply on the national broadcaster too. He knows my views, I know his views. I think that on this, my statement is abundantly clear.
Question.
Mr. Speaker, can the Honourable Member say whether Gibraltar Government debentures, as opposed to savings bank debentures, whether Gibraltar Government debentures are still open for public subscription?
Mr. Speaker, I understand that they are no longer available.
All right.
so that in fact local savers may now only invest in the savings bank where it does not reckon as public debt, as opposed to in the Gibraltar government where it does reckon as public debt, even though the savings bank is guaranteed by the Gibraltar government.
Yes, Mr. Speaker, that is the position.
And Mr. Speaker, it was a little bit difficult for me to follow exactly which of the answers, questions he was answering. When he said that he won't give me monthly information, was that in relation to the amounts paid by the Consolidated Fund to any special government or government-owned statutory corporation? Right, I didn't ask for that.
That's right, Mr. Speaker. It was in relation to that, but I did give him the amount in respect of companies, which was $1 million.
But I didn't ask for it on a monthly basis. I asked for it as at a certain date. Is he saying that he's going to refuse to answer this question next month?
Well, Mr. Speaker, the advice that I have is that that is a snapshot picture, which would change and means absolutely nothing, and that, in fact, the contributions to the funds are made at the end of the financial year. And I think that's always been the position.
I think I also said, Speaker,
that in six weeks, in effect, he will know what the position is going to be.
Question 218, the Honourable P.R. Caruana.
Mr. Speaker, can government say what goods and services have been procured by government since the 9th of December 2011 without going out to tender?
Answer, the Honourable the Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, as the Honourable Member knows, there is currently a backlog of EU directives dating back to 2004 that are pending transposition into Gibraltar law that relates to procurement. In line with its manifesto commitment, this government will prioritise transposing into Gibraltar law all EU directives on procurement, including those that relate to the procurement of services. It is anticipated that these directives will be made law very shortly. It is this government's policy that all goods and services which are above the prescribed tender thresholds set out in those directives are to be put out to tender as required by law. The government is not aware, having checked with the Treasury and the Procurement Office, of any goods or services provided for in these laws or above these thresholds which have been procured without going out to tender.
Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Member's answer is neither an answer to my question, nor is it consistent with an answer that he gave me in last month's Parliament. I haven't asked him what procurement has been done of goods and services above the value threshold, which are mandatory to be by public tender under EU directives. I have asked him what has been... You don't need an EU directive to go out to tender for every amount if it is your policy to go out to tender for any amount. Last month, he told this House, without reference to EU directives, that it was the policy of his government that, save in the case of urgency and other exigencies, were his exact words, it was the policy of his government that all procurements of goods and services should be by tender. That has nothing to do, will you not agree with me, with EU directives. Has the policy therefore changed during the last month such that it is no longer the policy as it was last month that all goods and services will be procured by public tender? Save urgency and exigency, to the one that he appears to have described by his answer today, which is that he will go out to tender above the EU requirement threshold when he has got round to doing those laws. Is it last month's, or is that the position today?
You see, Mr. Speaker, I don't recognise any inconsistency what I said last month and what I'm saying this month. In fact, Mr. Speaker, I don't believe that we have gone out for any goods or services to be procured that have not gone out either to tender or they have been dealt with in accordance with people who have pre-qualified to make supplying services to the government.
Well, that's the answer is none.
Well, exactly.
The answer to my question
is none. Mr. Speaker, and therefore, what I said to the Honourable Gentleman was that by checking with the Treasury and the Procurement Office, we do not believe that there was any procurement in excess of those thresholds. And Mr. Speaker, if this has suggested that the thresholds are only the EU thresholds, then it shouldn't have suggested it, because the position is that we will go out to tender for any goods and services that we need to obtain for the government, other than in cases of urgency or exigency, either with a tender per item or by pre-tendering, pre-approving people to provide things for the government, which it would just be impossible to be going out to tender for.
Well, Mr. Speaker, but that is not what he has told me in his answer. My question does not relate to EU directives. And what he has told me when he first answered the question, and indeed just repeated, is that he has checked with the Treasury, and as far as he can see, there are no procurements that haven't gone out to tender above the threshold that would be required by the EU directives. And my question does not relate or is not benchmarked against any EU directives. My question is, because last time he told me that it was the government policy, regardless of EU, the EU directives are mandatory tenders above a certain level. He told me last month that it was in any event the government's policy to go out to tender for everything, even below the EU threshold of mandatoriness, except for, I keep on saying it so that I'm not misquoting him, except for urgency and other exigencies. So I am asking him what has been procured by tender, to which he can say, I don't know, or I think nothing, but not have been procured by tender, but because last month I didn't make a great deal of progress with the Honourable Member in extracting from him what he meant by other exigencies. I can understand, because I have been sitting on that side for many years, that there are occasions where urgency of the need to procure make it impractical for the government to go out to tender. If something breaks down, if there is an emergency, there are any number of circumstances of genuine urgency where it would be quite absurd to expect the government to delay the procurement by the period of time that the tender process requires. That part of his answer last month caused me, therefore, no difficulty. But I was a little bit concerned by the undefined width of the term other or other exigencies. Other exigencies, unless further defined, could mean anything at all that they think. So, in other words, emergencies or other exigencies could mean, is capable of meaning, emergencies or whenever the government decides not to put it through the tender process. And I'm just trying to get him to, through interpretation of his examples, of which there are none, apparently, this last month, but he can do it dialectically across the floor of the House now if he wants to try and assist me further with the what the government understands and is there some curtailment, therefore, to the concept of other exigencies.
Mr. Speaker, there's absolutely no intention in this government of granting contracts for services for many millions of pounds without going out to tender, as was the case before the 9th of December when we came into office. It is not the intention of this government to procure anything other than by tender unless there is a great urgency or other exigency. There may be exigencies which are not urgent, Mr. Speaker. It's not urgency alone that could drive us to have to procure something by tender. But what I want the Honourable Gentleman to understand is that we would have to be in a very difficult position, absent urgency, before going down the route of procuring something other than by tender. because we think that is the fairest system and that's the best way for us to ensure that we're getting the best value for money for the people. Now, I mean, he says that he can understand the need on some occasions to not to go out to tender. Well, Mr. Speaker, I know that he and I have debated in this House things which have been procured for government which were not procured through tender, not as a result of any urgency. So he himself must understand that there are other exigencies, absent urgency, which sometimes may drive you to have to procure something not by tender. He and I have disagreed about what those exigencies were for him. I hope that if they ever come to us, and it may be that they never do, he and I may not disagree about it being an exigency. If it's helpful, Mr. Speaker, it would have to be, for my government, man bites dog, that we go out to procure something, not by tender, for a reason other than urgency.
Well, Mr. Speaker, I know that that is the stated policy, I've heard it before, of this new government. When he refers in his answer, unlike the previous government, absolutely right, it was not the policy of the previous government, as indeed it has never been the policy of any Gibraltar government before. Let's leave to one side the question of EU directives. It has never been the policy of any Gibraltar government, GSD, GSLP, AACR, IWBP before it, it has never been the policy of any Gibraltar government to go out to tender for the procurement of professional services. And that professional services, as the Honourable Member well knows to his benefit, includes legal fees, as it does architect services, as it does engineering services. Now, if the government is, this government is, of course, free to reverse that long-standing position. I mean, I think I can, if he wants as an aside, in the anteroom or at some other private occasion, I can tell him why I think previous Gibraltar governments did not go down the tender route for professional services, but that's a different matter. They're certainly free to take a different view. But will the Honourable Member agree with me that the practice of the tender process practice is one that if the Honourable Members apply, as they say, to everything except urgent matters and over a very sceptical chief minister that would have to be persuaded as a definition of exigency. Will he agree with me that it is reasonable for us then to interpret his answer, which I think does take the debate further than he took it last month, that given the height to which he has raised the threshold, not the urgency threshold, the other exigencies threshold that he has personally just raised it to, it would be legitimate of us in this House to ask him, to continue to ask him, of the occasions upon which he has been persuaded, despite his great scepticism and personal commitment to the contrary, to go down the non-tender route.
Mr. Speaker, yes. And if there is a reason which is grounded in public security or public policy, I will ask him to accept that I should tell him behind the Speaker's chair rather than across the floor of the House.
Cool.
But look, I want to be accountable for my actions, and it's the Honourable Member's job to make me accountable for my actions. And I don't want the government to be spending its money based on preference or favour to any particular person providing any particular goods. Now, there is a mechanism, which is this pre-authorization mechanism, which means that people pre-qualify to provide goods and services to the government. And I think that's an important...
That's a tender,
but it's a long-term supply tender, right? Which I think, frankly, works in keeping government going in all the things that it needs to be getting, which are not exceptional. I know that the stock of wine gums that the Honourable Gentleman used to have is running out, and I'm assuming we're not going to issue an advert to see who's going to replace them. Although, again, that's an issue that affects my diet, and we may be getting dried fruit instead of wine gums when they've run out. But, Mr. Speaker, otherwise, yes, I would expect that this is the sort of thing that, when it happens, is something that we can debate.
I don't know whether to interpret that, Mr. Speaker, as an admission on his part that he is in greater need of dieting than I am.
Absolutely.
Mr. Speaker, when I have asked him, I'm grateful to him for his last substantive answer, and I note the degree at which he has put the threshold. When I have asked him for examples today, he has prefixed his answer by saying, I have asked the financial secretary, whoever he said he'd asked, and as far as I am aware, etc., etc. Given the importance that he attaches, according to what he has just said, to the non-urgent out-of-tender procurement being an exception of which he should be persuaded, does he think it is appropriate that all procuring department heads should be aware of the strength of the government's policy position on this matter, that any exceptions, therefore, should be reported and recorded in his office, so that the next time I asked him, he is able to say there have been none or there have been the following ones? But if all he can ever tell me, because I realise where he sits in number six, he doesn't see the whole of the government machinery, if he's always going to come back to this house and say, I've asked, and no one has told me that there have been any, that is not reliably forensic about whether or not it's happened.
Mr. Speaker, it is the policy of the government that that should be the case, and it is the set-out policy of the government, because the Honourable Gentleman is asking me based on the fact that he knows it is the policy of the government, and I think when we started this debate last time, he was referring to statements in our manifesto before the election or otherwise. So I would have thought, Mr. Speaker, that anybody who is procuring services for the government is procuring it in line with the government's rules for procurement and the policy of the government. But absolutely, it's something that if somebody's going to go outside these rules, they'll have to persuade the political government, not necessarily me, their minister, who has been present in this debate, that they're going outside the tender procurement process in order to obtain relevant goods and services for the government. Absolutely.
Question 219, the Honourable P.R. Caruana.
Mr. Speaker, can the Chief Minister confirm that it's paperless government, this is at the risk of being called, what was it? Can the government confirm that its paperless government initiatives will allow and require email correspondence and other paperless communications to be safely stored, preserved and retrieved and audited indefinitely in the future?
Answer the Honourable the Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, the government has in place IT measures within the corporate network to securely store, preserve and retrieve any information held electronically for as long as required, and I won't pretend that that's been done since the 8th of December. Provisions for archiving and search and discovery solutions are currently being made in order to implement what's called data auditing. This has been an ongoing improvement commenced before the 8th of December. I'm advised by the government's own IT technicians that these tools will enable the government to use powerful analytics in order to comply with regulations as well as to maintain audit trails, manage and enforce corporate policies on any government retained electronic information. Which I think, Mr. Speaker, is to say yes to the question that he has asked in technical jargon.
Well, if you will humour a Luddite for a while longer, Mr. Speaker, this Luddite has it in his mind that, with a paper file, if somebody wants to review and research and audit and just look at the papers relating to a matter, it's all in a paper file marked, this or that. Is it implicit in the answer that he has just given me and the technical jargon that he has used in it that these records will be searchable as if they were all sitting in the same file, physically?
Yes, Mr. Speaker, and my experience from using a similar system in private practice suggests that it's actually easier to find when they are in this form and once the system is up and running, than if they are in a paper file, because usually documents are indexed either in a way that every word on the page is available to search for, or the document, if it is a document not created by a computer, it is something scanned into a computer, is given tag words to enable the document to be found when those tag words are put in, or it can be found by date order, which was
probably the way the Honourable Gentleman will go to a file to look for something that he remembered. In other words, either looking for the specific word or document or looking around the date that it might have been created. Mr. Speaker, it is, in my view, the right initiative if we're also going to make archive material available, because as we start going forward and we create new material, it will be easier to archive and make available. And I'm quite happy to say to the Honourable Gentleman, Mr. Speaker, that email at the pain of being called a Luddite myself, which I don't think I'm going to encourage, but email can sometimes be a curse, and people can say short things in internal communications, okay, or see you later, the sort of thing that you might not usually have archived and might have been a telephone conversation, which will be there forever. So people who are using email now need to know that, you know, those things will be searchable and available, and they need to say to friends that this is a work email address and that it's the government email address that will be the government's archive. But yes, Mr. Speaker, it should all be searchable and kept for good in this format.
Grateful to the Honourable Member. And will it, I mean, it's not necessarily implicit in the fact that it can be done, that it will be done. Is it the government's intention, once the system is in place and up and running, which I acknowledge is not yet, that the creation of paper copies will be discouraged, so that the government is going to try and get used to working without paper? So if somebody sends an email with an attachment, with a document attached, people will be discouraged, or not required at least, to print them out and put them in a file. In other words, is that the philosophy or the policy? So because it is searchable and auditable and all that, in order to get the principle, yes, I think he's understood the question, that people will not be expected to keep a paper file as well.
But Mr. Speaker, with this nuance, that operating a paperless office doesn't mean that you don't print things out ever, because very often we are human beings and we sometimes appear to be able to interact better with a piece of paper if we're checking an agreement than we can with a screen. So very often people, when they're receiving documents that they need to work on, will want to print them at least as working copies, and they won't necessarily want to shred that. They may want to put it in a file in order to keep it with their notes, etc. So what is happening already is that people, ministers in particular, are looking at things on screens where that is viable. And it's not, Mr. Speaker, that this system is not already in place. It's that it's being improved, and I recognise that if it's already in place, it must have been put in place as a matter of good IT management before the 8th of December. He may have noticed, Mr. Speaker, that even in Parliament, each minister is only bringing copies of their own questions in paper form. Copies of questions being answered by other ministers are being made available to the ministers in the old days, you will recall they all brought copies of everybody else's, on their iPads, so they're able to follow which question I'm on and the answer that I have programmed to give on their iPads. Some of them have more
iPads to the opposition, we'll do the same.
Mr. Speaker, I'm perfectly open to an opposition request that the taxpayer should provide them with iPads. That's absolutely no problem at all. Some of my members are more or less enamoured of their iPads. I mean, most of them have taken to them like ducks to water. We save an amount of paper there. Speaker, the hope is, and the aim is, not just of this government, but I'm sure of many professional organisations and many governments, to be able to cut down the amount of paper that we use insofar as is reasonable without affecting how we have records forever of the things that we are doing, and it is in the interests of our community that we should forever have records of. In fact, the whole aim is to make those records more permanent, more lasting, and more easily searchable within the confines of political conventions.
Question 220, the Honourable P.R. Caruana.
Mr. Speaker, will the Chief Minister say how much advertising by monetary cost has been placed by the government since the 9th of December 2011 with, one, the Gibraltar Chronicle, two, the Panorama, three, the 7 days, four, the New People, and five, any other newspaper or magazine? And I hope that's not too far from the way he used to formulate the question.
Answer, the Honourable, the Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, the government has been invoiced 6,363 spot 85 of which £1,400 has been paid and £3,963.85 is pending payment. Cost by newspapers is broken down as follows since the 9th of December. The Gibraltar Chronicle has invoiced £4,404 and had £1,400 paid and £3,004 is pending payment. The Panorama has invoiced £1,669.85 and that amount is pending payment. Gibsport has invoiced £290 and that amount is pending payment. The 7 Days newspaper has not invoiced anything and has not been paid anything, and the New People newspaper has neither invoiced anything nor had any advert placed and has therefore not been paid anything. This information is now being made available on a monthly basis on the government website, worked out on the basis of what has actually been paid and not on the basis of monetary cost. And if I can just say to the Honourable Gentleman, I think I used to ask what has been paid, and when he's put the question in terms of monetary cost, he's made us think whether he was asking us what adverts had been placed, not yet invoiced for, and not yet paid, which I'm told we couldn't work out. He may be interested to know that the information which is now on the website actually goes back to the 24th of June 2011, the day after he last answered my question, so that whoever is interested can continue to trace through since the time I last asked the question in this House, what amounts have been paid to any of the relevant publications. This, in my view, Mr. Speaker, is information that should have been up in January. It wasn't up in January, it's now up in February. The Honourable Gentleman has had to ask the question for us to realise that it wasn't on the website. It will now be on the website on a monthly basis so he can ask questions arising from the data rather than to have to ask for the data.
Question 221, the Honourable P.R. Caruana.
Yes, Mr. Speaker, can the Chief Minister say whether the government is committed to paying or intends to make any payment from public funds towards the past or present occupational pension arrangements of the past or present employees of the Gibraltar Chronicle newspaper or Gibraltar Chronicle printers?
Answer, the Honourable the Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, no, sir.
Mr. Speaker, will the Honourable Member confirm that his no is a comprehensive no on the subject matter and not no to the question as formulated? In other words, that it is not the government's intention to fund in any way, directly or indirectly, the pensions liability of a company that it does not own, such as the Gibraltar Chronicle.
Mr. Speaker, although I should only be answering the question as asked, but his interpretation is correct.
Question 223, the Honourable P.R. Caruana.
Mr. Speaker.
No.
223.
I tried to save you. Mr. Speaker, will the Chief Minister say whether the government has yet decided whether it will proceed with 1, building the tunnel under the eastern beach end of the runway, and 2, a new power station at Lathbury Barracks Parade Ground?
Answer, the Honourable the Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, in respect of the project relating to the tunnel under the runway, the government is going to tender for the completion of the works. This will require an EU procurement procedure. Mr. Speaker, in respect of the proposed new power station at Lathbury Barracks Parade Ground, the government is in advanced negotiations with the joint venture partners, Volker Stevin Construction Europe and ETDESA, to determine whether we will proceed with the project as presently envisaged or with modifications.
Mr. Speaker, I acknowledge two things. One, the conversation we had last week about legal implications, and I also acknowledge the fact that the government goes out to tender doesn't mean it is obliged to proceed with actually carrying out the project. But can I ask the Honourable Member, subject to those two caveats, whether the answer means that, in principle, they have decided as a matter of policy to proceed with
a power station, if the price is right, can be right, can be made right, in their view, and a tunnel, if the price is one that they're happy to accept on the conclusion of that tender. So that what I'm just trying to find out is whether there is now political commitment to the concept of a tunnel proceeding and the need to build a new power station at Lathbury Barracks.
Mr. Speaker, the issue in respect of the tunnel really has always been cost, and I know that it must also have been cost before the 8th of December, because the contract to do it for 30 million went pear-shaped, and the Honourable Gentleman knows that I've discussed that with him. So cost is an issue. I think you'd find unanimity in Gibraltar that a tunnel would be the preferred option as long as it is affordable, and it may be that we have to have an argument about what is or is not affordable in the future, but in principle we believe a tunnel would be the best option for people to cross the runway vehicularly. In terms of the power station, Mr. Speaker, cost is also very much the leading consideration, and he knows that we have differences as to what the appropriate cost of that perhaps should be, and that's why we're discussing these issues. But there are, of course, other questions which are relevant in respect of the power station, not least complying with European environmental directives, and in any event wanting to find the best method for generating electricity in the safest and most secure fashion for our community. And it may be that we don't disagree with decisions that the Honourable Gentleman made before the election, or it may be that we do, once we've had these further negotiations and we've seen what further options might have been available to him. Or, Mr. Speaker, because this is an area which I acknowledge is in flux, if technologies have moved on from the time that he commissioned a report into the issue and he was advised in respect of one particular technology.
Question 224, the Honourable P.R. Caruana.
Mr. Speaker, can the Chief Minister say whether he believes that the economic interests of Gibraltar require that additional office accommodation be built?
Answer, the Honourable the Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, the government believes that additional office accommodation will be required as new business is attracted to Gibraltar. The government will not, however, finance the new development of office space by private developers.
My question was not aimed at the second part of his question, which would put him in a very awkward spot, given how critical they were of the previous government, when as a last resort we indicated that we would be willing to do it. But the first half of the answer is really the one that I was hoping to explore, because, Mr. Speaker, it begs the very question that I think is at stake here. The Honourable Member has said in answer to the question, can the Chief Minister say whether he believes that the economic interests of Gibraltar require that additional office accommodation be built? He has said effectively, yes, as new businesses are attracted, office accommodation will be required as new businesses are attracted to Gibraltar. And will the Chief Minister agree with me that precisely the point is that there is a chicken and egg situation, and that the chicken and the egg need to resolve their differences in the opposite way to the way that he's just described in his answer? Because if accommodation is only available as businesses are attracted to Gibraltar, they will never be attracted to Gibraltar, because the availability of suitable office accommodation is one of the factors that businesses take into account in deciding whether to put Gibraltar on the short list of alternative locations, of various possible locations for their business. And this is why the previous government became so concerned, because the private sector was, for banking crisis reasons, unable to obtain bank funding for it. And we were being told that insurance companies and other economic activity was finding that there was insufficient quality of business accommodation. Hence the question, designed to get to the conclusion of my urging the government to take the view that a stock of office accommodation, a stock of suitable type of office accommodation, needs to be available speculatively in order to attract businesses to Gibraltar, rather than only be provided as businesses are attracted to Gibraltar
which is too late for the business to actually come here.
Mr. Speaker, it is a chicken and egg situation. Is it if you build it, they will come? Or is it that if you don't build it, they can never come?
If you don't build it, they can't come.
Mr. Speaker, we built it. He turned it into a hospital. And therefore, Mr. Speaker, the issue really is this. Is it that the private sector cannot bank any of its projects to build offices? Well, Mr. Speaker, we don't think that is the situation at the moment, and we don't think that there's been a dramatic change since the 8th of December. In fact, all the evidence I've seen suggests that there is more than one project to build offices, which is likely to be taking off very soon indeed, although one project, which should have been a flagship, may not take off.
Mr. Speaker, we're talking about the supply and demand equation today, where the economy of Gibraltar has tripled in size from when the days of the office building to which he is referring to had laid vacant for many years and would have laid vacant for many more years in an economically unviable fashion for its then owners. The question is that, as he knows, that there is a 2 or 3 year lead to office from an office development being conceived and commenced to it being available for occupation. I'm not pressing the Honourable Member as to why he hasn't built any offices yet. I'm simply trying to establish consensus with him that one of the obstacles at present to the success, to any success that the Honourable Mr. Likudi may enjoy in attracting more gaming companies to Gibraltar, if that's what the government wants to do, or new banks or insurance companies or any other financial in Gibraltar, his success will be in vain if when they get here and come to look, that they cannot be physically accommodated in office space and therefore go elsewhere. And this is not an attack on the government. I'm simply sharing with them our experience over the last 18 months or so in government, that the chicken and egg equation has been determined by the government. People come, look, see the office accommodation that is available. There's always a little bit. But it's not what they're looking for, and therefore cross Gibraltar off the line. And one of the things that we need to put in place, will he agree with me, is somehow encouraging private sector development, which I agree with him is by far the most preferable way of doing it, to get on with building these offices so that the government, whatever success the government has in attracting additional business to Gibraltar, can actually be accommodated.
Well, Mr. Speaker, I mean, I think he's asking me to agree with something that I can certainly agree with, which is that we can encourage private sector development of more suitable office space. But of course, private sector development will do so when it considers that there will be a market there, not to provide a bank of offices for Gibraltar. But he says rightly, Mr. Speaker, that there is a 3 or 4 year lead to the development of offices. And he says rightly, Mr. Speaker, that there isn't at the moment a bank of office space. Well, Mr. Speaker, that is the position that we inherited 2 months ago from the government that he was leading. So, I mean, without the need to get into something which might be less than a convivial discussion about it, where we can agree that private sector developers should be encouraged to develop offices for the expansion that we expect that there will be in Gibraltar's economy in the next 4 years, what we are not going to do, and this is a clear dividing line between us, is help them in financing it by providing them with cash. That is something that the Honourable Gentleman suggested he might be prepared to do as a joint venture partner, as an equity investor in one particular project. And we said at the time, and we maintain, that that will not be the tack that we take. Short of that, can there be agreement across the floor of the House that there should be private sector development of office space encouraged by government and opposition? Well, yes, Mr. Speaker, and he obviously agrees with us that Gibraltar is going to expand quite substantially in the coming 4 years, and we're going to need it. And I'm grateful for his, I won't call it U-turn, I'll just say support.
Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Member is not correct. The previous government never intended to provide cash, as he calls it. We weren't offering to finance a private property development. In fact, we made it perfectly clear that we were not willing to do that. What we were willing to do was to take part as joint venture equity partners on a matching basis. In other words, a public investment in offices, just as there are public investment in many things. And I have to say that Will the Honourable Member not agree with me that too hard and fast a commitment to the view that he has just expressed is capable of becoming illogical and irrational? This idea that there are no circumstances in which the Honourable Members can be persuaded that it would be an appropriate use of public funds to assist or participate as an equity investor in the building of offices, so that, for example, if the government was certain that the economic prosperity and development and sustainability of our economy were being constrained, were being held back, were being prejudiced by the lack of offices, which may not be due to the fact that developers don't see demand, but simply that banks, because they've got their own balance sheet problems, are simply not lending for property developments, regardless of what demand there may be for the finished product, that in those circumstances, the government will continue anchored in the view that better to let the economy of Gibraltar suffer structural, macro economic damage than do whatever may be necessary to provide it with the office space that it needs. I agree that it's much better. Governments are not in the business of building offices. But governments are in the business of ensuring the success of our economy. And if the success of our economy, for reasons outside of the government's control, meant that it had to resort to the extraordinary exigency of making itself an office property developer, does he not agree that in those circumstances it would be the right thing to do?
Mr. Speaker, in the very exigent circumstances that the Honourable Gentleman describes, yes, it would be the right thing to do. We don't recognise that that has happened in Gibraltar in the past 4 years, and that he was put in that position when he was about to make an equity investment, which is providing cash, Mr. Speaker, whether we express it one way or another. You see, Mr. Speaker, we don't see the position developing in the way... I'm not suggesting that the Honourable Gentleman was a lender, Mr. Speaker. You provide cash when you're an equity investor as well. Mr. Speaker, but I don't see the position being as the Honourable Gentleman posits, for reasons that he's probably in a better position to understand than me, because there are two particular types of office development that he will know of, because they haven't arisen in the past 8 weeks, which are very likely to take off, which don't rely on bank financing, and which would provide the sort of office environment that he and I might think is relevant in the future. And Mr. Speaker, the government is not in the business of building offices, because we are not developers. We're in the business of building other things. We build industrial parks, which include some offices. We build homes for rent or for co-ownership. But investing in the project that the Honourable Gentleman was thinking of investing on simply didn't enjoy the confidence of us when we were in the opposite benches. And it wouldn't enjoy our support today as a government, in particular, given that we know that there are two projects in the pipeline at different levels, in that pipeline that are likely to come to fruition and are likely to provide the sort of accommodation that the Honourable Gentleman thinks is appropriate. And I agree.
Does the Honourable Member not acknowledge that the reason why the previous government did not proceed with that investment, which the previous government's position was always that as a last resort, it would invest public funds to ensure that the economy of Gibraltar did not suffer. For 2 years, we were unable to find a single developer willing to commit to start an investment in the knowledge that even when they had started, it would take them 3 years to bring it online. And that position was publicly abandoned by the government, does he acknowledge, precisely when the proposed development that he's just referring to came online. The possibility, he may recall, he was present at Gibraltar Day in London last year when I said that the government was in negotiations which would result in it not having to proceed as a developer itself. That is a project facilitated by an agreement which the government has also been highly critical of in the last few weeks. One of the two projects in question is that. I don't know if that's the project he had in mind or the other one more in Queensway. Both projects are good projects.
Both deserve to be supported and encouraged, and I agree entirely with the Honourable Member. If both, perhaps if one of those, just one of those, proceeded, then it would not be necessary for the government to invest public funds.
Will you acknowledge?
Yes.
Well, Mr. Speaker, I'm not able to say when the Honourable Gentleman decided not to invest and what was happening at the time behind the impenetrable curtain. But what I will say is that we're discussing what is happening today. And look, in these circumstances, we don't believe we are in the last resort. We don't necessarily accept what the Honourable Gentleman has said about the one issue that has been the subject of a public dispute between us outside of this House in respect of one particular office development. But I will only say this, Mr. Speaker. I was in Gibraltar Day in London this year, and I've extended an invitation already publicly for the Leader of the Opposition, whoever he or she may be, to be there this year too, something that was not a courtesy extended to me or to my predecessor.
Question 220. Question 225, the Honourable Pierre Caruana.
Mr. Speaker, can the Chief Minister say what was the cleaning cost of the new air terminal in respect of one, cleaning carried out before it opened for arriving passengers, and two, the weekly cleaning costs in respect of the period from the date of its opening for arriving passengers to the current date, and in the case of the latter, give a breakdown by week. In other words, the weekly cost after opening and the cost before opening.
Answer the Honourable the Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, with of assistance to the Honourable Gentleman, I'm going to read what's here, but then I'm happy to give him a copy of what I'm going to read. Mr. Speaker, the information available to the government is as follows, and it straddles the two administrations. The cleaning carried out before the new air terminal opened for arriving passengers, assuming the Honourable Member means from the date the terminal was handed over to the government, was handled by Dragados as part of their contract. The cost to the government of the cleaning on the days the airport was open for pre-election tours was handled by GJBS Limited at a total cost of £35,889. The invoiced weekly cleaning cost in respect of the period from the date of the opening of the airport for arriving passengers to date is as follows. For the first week, from the 26th to the 27th of November, that's just one day because of the way the weeks have been worked out, £280 spot 80 pence. For the second week, from the 28th of November to the 4th of December 2011, £904 spot 80 pence. Week 3, from the 5th of December to the 11th of December, 904 spot 80 pence. And for the fourth week, which is from the 12th to the 18th of December 2011, 904 spot 80 pence. For the fifth week, the 19th to the 25th of December, 748 spot 80 pence. And for the sixth week, the 26th of December to the 31st of December, 904 spot 80 pence. I think there's one day missing in the other week because Christmas Day the terminal is closed in Gibraltar. We have not been invoiced for daytime cleaning for January and February to date. The weekly cost has increased to 1,453 spot 60 per week as the cleaning hours have increased due to the cancellation of the nighttime cleaning contract service provided by GJBS, and that was cancelled on the 9th of January 2012. A nighttime cleaning service was contracted by the previous government through GJBS Limited during the public viewing days. The rates were based on a short-term contract basis and included what I'm told was a markup by GJBS Limited. An invoice for the initial period of arrivals of operations from the 25th of November to the 10th of December was expected for 88,281 spot 90. That is an astonishing figure for 2 weeks of nighttime cleaning contracted by the previous administration. This figure was challenged by the new government. As a result of this, GJBS Limited have reviewed the matter and the invoice for the period, for the longer period, of the 24th of November 2011 to the 8th of January, so in other words, not from the 25th of November to the 10th of December, but from the 24th of November to the 8th of January, is now
122,840.13. The nighttime cleaning service was cancelled on the 9th of January 2012, as I've just told the House.
It's precisely that presentation of that misrepresentation of statistics that appeared in
the point of order, Mr. Speaker. I think we've had an afternoon where we've been able to put points to each other, which are political points in a political way. But to say that I've misrepresented anything when I'm providing the Honourable Gentleman with figures that I've been provided by those that operate the terminal for the government, I think starts to stray into the area where we're going to have arguments which we don't need to have.
Does the Leader of Opposition wish to...
No, I wish to be allowed to finish my answer, and then you will understand that is not quite... The question, I beg your pardon. It's precisely that distorted representation, then, if he doesn't want like the word misrepresentation. It's precisely that distorted representation of the comparability of figures, which he has just read out, which were contained also in the government's press release, that has motivated me to ask this question. Does the Honourable Member not understand that to compare the cost of cleaning post-opening, once the cleaning from a building site to a clean terminal had been carried out, and then comparing it to the weekly cost after that, which was just cleaning the daily soil, the daily dirt, rubbish, is not a fair comparison. That before it opened to tender, there wasn't the 3, 4, 5, or 6, I don't know what the contingent is, that are bought in now to do the regular cleaning. There was an army of cleaners required to clean a terminal which had been a building site and convert it into the condition in which it could open for business. And that beyond that, the cleaning contract was to maintain it clean and not to clean it. Does he therefore acknowledge that to compare what is in effect a lump sum deployed over a number of days is not comparing apples to apples when the other apple is the daily cost of maintaining it clean?
Mr. Speaker, I know that the Honourable Gentleman has got the problem that the airport contract has gone pear-shaped for him. But we are comparing apples with apples. I said specifically that the cost of cleaning the terminal from, or that part of the terminal that was handed over to the government, given the previous administration's angst to receive something to operate down there before the election, and to operate tours which operated as almost a live manifesto, that cost, Mr. Speaker, of going from building site to keys handed over was handled by Dragados as part of their contract. I haven't given a figure for that, Mr. Speaker. Then the government, and of course, Mr. Speaker, I assume that when a contractor hands over a site, he doesn't hand it over as if it were, you know, something to hand over where you could eat your lunch off the floor. Then the government spent an amount of money in getting it into the condition that the then government wanted it to be for these pre-election tours. That cost £35,889. That cost £35,889. So the contractor cleans it, we don't know for how much, and hands it over. And it's perfectly normal, Mr. Speaker, that when you get a building back from a contractor, you might think it's not as clean as I want it to be before I can start operating it or showing it off as my flagship project. And that cost £35,000. Mr. Speaker, that's a lot of money to spend on cleaning. But it's a quarter, or just over a quarter, of the £122,000. Let me just get that right. £122,000 that it cost to clean the terminal from the 25th of November, open for arrivals from that day, Mr. Speaker, to the 9th of January. Because, of course, Mr. Speaker, if it is in the politician's mind that he is definitely going to open at least a part of this airport before the election. Not just for tours, not just for Manifesto Live, but for operations, for arrivals. Well, Mr. Speaker, look, I perfectly understand that you're operating in a building site and that it costs a lot of money to clean a building site every day. And it's cost a hell of a lot of money, Mr. Speaker, £122,000, until a more sensible government grabbed the bull by the horns, found a different way of ensuring that the terminal was cleaned, and it now costs, instead of £122,000 for the 7-week period between the 25th of November and the 9th of January, it now costs £1,453 a week. Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Gentleman can say, Fabian, or here I suppose you should call me Honourable Member, you need to multiply what it costs per week now by the number of weeks for which it has cost £122,000 to compare like with like. Well, you know what, Mr. Speaker, I might be prepared to agree with that. He can do it himself, Mr. Speaker. He can multiply 1,453 by 7, and he can compare that to the £122,000. It is likely, Mr. Speaker, that he is going to find that he has spent, or he gave orders for spending, £112,000 more than had to be spent to keep that terminal clean and open for arrivals, Mr. Speaker. That is, in my view, Mr. Speaker, the most obvious case of financial neglect that we have found since we were elected into government in respect of this terminal to date. But, Mr. Speaker, I'm also happy to tell him, and he'll be very happy to learn, that I took another executive decision in respect of this terminal, and that was to switch the lights off at night, because he wanted them switched on for it to look tremendously beautiful. And I said, look, the environmental issues matter more to us. You can switch the lights off when there ain't anybody there.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Speaker, I don't know whether he's saying that the GJBS, which is a government-owned company, went out to pay £122,000 for what should have cost them £35,000. I don't know whether that is what he's saying. Or I don't know whether he is saying that I said to GJBS, no, even though it can be done for £35,000, go out and find somebody that will charge you £122,000. I don't know what nature of allegation he is making against the management of a government-owned company that was simply instructed to clean the terminal. But certainly, some sort of allegation he is making, because he cannot possibly believe that I personally or any minister engaged themselves in the sub-sub-contract, given that JBS was a subcontractor of the contract, and the cleaner was a subcontractor of the subcontractor. I don't know if he's suggesting whether government ministers engaged and found and negotiated with the cleaner. So, given that he cannot possibly believe that, he is either making the most serious of allegations against the management of JBS, or he is continuing, and I would prefer to think it was the latter, or he is continuing to fail to understand the point that I am making. And that is that the process of cleaning a building the size of this air terminal from the moment that the government were allowed access to it in order to prepare for the live manifesto and in order to prepare to have as many voters as possible see it before polling day, that as a one-off cost, which would have had to be done at some stage and was advanced, according to him, for electoral purposes, that is a one-off cost which cannot fairly be compared with the cost during any period starting after that effort had been made. And that effort was not a one-day effort or a one-week effort. It took quite a long time to get the building into that clean enough condition. It wasn't done by 100 women in one night.
It's not just women who clean, eh?
No, mostly, no, I seem to, when I used to go down, there was only women there.
Well, Mr. Speaker, I mean, clearly the Honourable Gentleman and I have different views of the world. You see, I don't just think it's women who clean. Mr. Speaker, you see, the Honourable Gentleman is doing what he best does politically, which is to try and pretend that he can talk about something other than the very serious inheritance that he left this government. You see, Mr. Speaker, I have not made any allegation against my great friends at GJBS who do such fantastic work for the government and for the community. I have made, in fairly transparent form, Mr. Speaker, an allegation of negligence and financial mismanagement against him.
What?
Although, of course, Mr. Speaker, he would rather now say that the airport terminal had nothing to do with him, that he wasn't the clerk of works, that he wasn't on top of everything that was happening there, that he wasn't the person who came down there and threw his hat on the floor when it didn't look like he thought it should look in time for the election, Mr. Speaker. He was the clerk of works, he knew everything that was happening. I sent him back his boots, Mr. Speaker, because he left them at 6 Convent Place that he used to use when he walked on site on all of these projects. Mr. Speaker, it is impossible for him to wriggle out of this. The sum of £122,000 is not the sum that it cost to get the terminal into the state in which it could start to operate for arrivals. Let me make it clear. I know he's clever enough to understand it, but he's trying to obfuscate so that people don't understand what he did. The sum to get this terminal up to scratch for arrivals is A, an indeterminate amount paid by Dragados Singh handing over the site and cleaning it, such as they might understand cleaning to be, and second, £35,889, and then it opens for pre-election tours. Mr. Speaker, from that moment on, from the moment that the terminal is open for arrivals, the cleaning, the continued cleaning, so therefore it must have been clean enough to open for arrivals. Otherwise, the Honourable Gentleman opened up a place that wasn't clean enough for arrivals in his haste to open something up in time for the election. From the date that the terminal opened for arrivals and was operating until we grabbed the reins and stopped it, for the 7-week period between the 25th of November to the 9th of January, the cost of cleaning overnight, in other words, the same areas cleaned each night, was £122,000. £122,000. Mr. Speaker, they can divide by 7 and they can get the weekly amount. That's what it cost. And it would have continued to cost that per week if we hadn't stopped it. It now costs £1,453 per week. And the terminal is clean and open for arrivals. Although, Mr. Speaker, we have made no bones of the fact that we considered closing the terminal for arrivals. Because it is only in the mind of the Honourable Gentleman, in his pre-election frenzy, that it can have appeared reasonable to have 2 airports operating within 50 yards of each other, one for arrivals and one for departure, just because he needed them to be open in time for the election. But in terms of the financial cost, it is absolutely clear. What was done for £122,000 in 7 weeks, we are now doing for £1,453. Therefore, Mr. Speaker, if we had done it from the 25th of November to the 9th of January, it would have cost £10,000. The shortfall to the taxpayer, Mr. Speaker, is £110,000. Because the Honourable Gentleman wanted to open a terminal for arrivals in time for the election. Mr. Speaker, there are so many things that we could have done with that money that would have been better for the community. Forget our arguments about the cost of the terminal. Just that cleaning cost.
Mr. Speaker, then, having heard the Honourable Member again, does he agree with me that he obliges me to change my mind? That of the two options that I gave him before, making serious allegations against the management of JBS, or not comparing apples with apples, and I told him that I would prefer to think that it was the second, I've got to change my mind, having heard him now, it's got to be the first. He must be making serious allegations against the persons that he says are his great friends, because, Mr. Speaker,
It's not up to you to decide.
I have to listen to the
Speaker, the Honourable Gentleman has put that point before, and I've made very clear that I'm not making allegations against anyone at JBS. I've said the opposite. I specifically spelt it out. He is not allowed, Mr. Speaker, to put words into my mouth, in particular in respect to something as serious as saying that I'm making an allegation against someone, when I specifically told the House that I am not. If he wants to tell the House that I'm lying, he can put a motion. I can tell him now what the result would be.
I am telling the House that there are two possible explanations for what he is saying in it. One, that he is making serious allegations against those who administer and issue the contract, or he is not comparing apples with apples, because he must know that I personally, I know that he is desperate to make this stick on me personally, but he must know that I personally neither negotiate nor award, nor find cleaners. And that what ministers do is say to the government's company, get the air terminal clean. And if the person to whom the government says, get the air terminal clean, chooses to do something as outrageous as he appears to think what they did is, then either they are incompetent, serious allegation, or worse, even more serious allegation. Because it is not me or any other minister that knew of or agreed to or brought about or procured a situation where something that he thinks should cost 1/7 of what it actually costs 7 times more than that. And because however many times he may, for political effect, repeat the allegation as if it was being an allegation made against me, he must know that I am responsible in the sense that I was responsible for everything that happens in the government or under the government, but that I am not directly the cause of that situation being the case, however politically responsible I may be for it as the head of the whole government organisation. And as he continues to insist that this is some outrageous act, it can only be an outrageous act by those who perpetrated it, not by those who simply asked for the terminal to be clean and then find that it costs what the Honourable Member thinks is outrageous. And I have to say one more thing to the Honourable Member.
I have to ask
whether he will agree with me.
What?
Exactly. I'll convert it into a question. Don't worry.
No.
Will the Honourable Member not agree?
Look, Mr. Speaker.
I have sat here as a point of order. I have sat here quietly listening to all the diatribe and allegations and bitterness that he has just uttered. I have not jumped out up like a nervous jack in the box trying to prevent him from uttering what he has done. He should do the same be man enough.
We just ask questions, we say what we want.
Well, I am asking a question, but he won't let me finish it, Mr. Speaker. It takes so long because he tries to stop me asking it, because he doesn't want me to populate the question.
Well,
Mr. Speaker.
Before the Honourable, the Leader of Opposition carries on,
yes.
A point of order has been raised.
Yes.
And I have to rule on that. I was waiting to hear the question. Exactly. There's been a very long preamble, but I'm promised. But since I'm promised that the question is on its way, and right now, the question I hope will be phrased correctly, which will help me to overcome the point of order. So when I hear the question, I'll be in a better position to rule on the point of order.
Yes.
Well, Mr. Speaker, the question is this, and I'll go straight to it without any preamble whatsoever.
You had the preamble.
The Honourable Member agree? Doesn't the Honourable Member agree that thanks to the personal and careful interest taken by ministers and the GSD government in the execution of government projects, nobody has had to suffer the consequences of the gross negligence that resulted from the careless execution by the previous GSLP government of almost all of their projects?
Before the Chief Minister asks the question, yes, but dealing now with the point of order, you know, the point of order which the Honourable Chief Minister raised, is it now clear from the questioner that he is not attributing to the Chief Minister any blame on the any allegation on the members of GJBS? Because that is the issue which the Honourable Leader opposite started his question with, and that's what caused the Chief Minister to rise.
I have said, and I have repeated after he has made the point of order, that the things that he is accusing me of can only mean one of two things, and it's his choice. And I refuse to withdraw one of the two choices. Facts are only capable of two explanations, and I am entitled to identify what those two explanations are. Mr. Speaker, he cannot say to me that I have perpetrated the most serious example of public financial dereliction that he has found, and expect me to accept that as if I was personally the perpetrator of the facts that he believes results in that dereliction. And when I say to him that it can't possibly mean that unless you're saying this, he says, no, if you say that, you're making a serious allegation. Well, Mr. Speaker, look, debate in Parliament is not possible. I am saying to him that as he knows that I am not the person that agrees the price for the cleaning contract, he must either be making all the suggestions that he is making against me about the person who does allocate the cleaning contracts, or he agrees with me that he's not comparing like with like.
Anyway, the question has moved on since then.
Well, Mr. Speaker, I think that we have to deal with the Honourable Gentleman as the punch drunk clown he is. Drunk on sour grapes that have made the wine.
As unparliamentary
as calling somebody a nervous jack in the box, well, Mr. Speaker.
Order. I'm well aware of.
Well, that's your view.
I'm well aware of the Honourable Chief Minister's desire to generally lower the tempo in this House, and I'm sure you'll agree with me. Language this punch drunk clown does not really help.
It is not a question of it not helping. It is a question of being unparliamentary language. Unparliamentary language is not either just the use of the word lie or any word which offends him, which are used from the opposition benches, which appears to be the emerging rule. The people of Gibraltar have elected me to the office of Chief Minister 4 times in a row, which is greater than the number of months that he has been in office for the first time. Unless he is insulting the people of Gibraltar by thinking that they are capable of repeatedly electing a clown into the highest office of the land, he is lying and misleading this House.
Mr. Speaker, this is what he wants Parliament to become. Because it's clear to me, Mr. Speaker, that the Honourable Gentleman defines himself by his combative style and by his enemies. He can call me a nervous jack in the box, but I can't call him a punch drunk clown in his estimation. Let's move on from all of those things, Mr. Speaker. And if like is all it takes, then I'm quite happy to say that he's just like a punch drunk clown, but not really one. So, Speaker, this is an important debate. This is an important debate. And we should be having it, if he wanted to have a debate, on the basis of a motion, but he's asked a question. Questions are about elucidating information. He doesn't like the information that he's getting. I am not making any allegation whatsoever against my friends in GJBS, Mr. Speaker. But he wants it to be that I am doing so that he can wriggle off the hook that he made for himself. Does he think, Mr. Speaker, that anyone in Gibraltar
believes that he would not be responsible for determining exactly what was happening in that terminal. Does he think, Mr. Speaker, that Gibraltar is a big enough place that nobody knew that he was going down there almost every day to make sure that it was perfect for his manifesto, Mr. Speaker? Does he really think,
Mr. Speaker? Mr. Speaker, this is complete on a point of order. He is accusing me of lying. I have told this House repeatedly that I am not aware of the contract. Is he saying, by suggesting in to you that I used to go down to review the progress of works, that therefore I must be telling an untruth in this House when I say that I had no idea what the cleaning arrangements were or how much they cost? Because that is all he's doing on his feet right now. He is trying to suggest that it is not credible that I did not know what the cleaning costs or arrangements were. And since I have said twice that I can recall that that is the case, then he's simply accusing me of lying. Mr. Speaker, look, I am very happy for standing orders to be binned. I have quite thick skin and very broad shoulders, and I don't mind what language is used in this House. The point that I'm making is that he is the first one to leap up and complain whenever anybody uses a word against him. Either we are both allowed to use words, or neither of us should use words. All I'm complaining about is a situation in which only we are not allowed to use words, but they are.
Well, I don't believe there exists a situation where only one side is not allowed to use unparliamentary language. That applies to both sides. If the Honourable Member is referring to the remark of punch-drunk clown, I have ruled it is not a helpful remark in the context of the spirit in which we intend to conduct this proceedings.
So is it parliamentary?
Well, it is no less and no more parliamentary than accusing somebody else of being like a jack-in-the-box. I think we ought to play the game by the same rules. If one member sees fit to accuse another of being like a jack-in-the-box, then being a punch-drunk clown is not far removed from a jack-in-the-box. But again, I do not condone and I do not wish to encourage the use of any language of that nature. Leaving aside the description unparliamentary, I know of no argument that is enhanced by hurling insults across the floor. So I think if we can all work to that rule that let's avoid language which is likely to inflame the situation, I think we'll all achieve a lot more. Now, talking about the way this debate has arisen, there was a question from the Honourable Leader of Opposition asking for cleaning costs. I have read the answer and I've heard the answer. The answer has been provided in a factual manner. Then the Leader of Opposition has, in fact, referred to that answer as a misrepresentation in the first instance. And when that was challenged, he changed, distorts the representation of the facts. What the Honourable Leader of the Opposition has done is placed, he's treated this question, it's a line of supplementary, into a trial, if I may call it that way, of his conduct of the cleaning costs. And with respect, having done so, he can hardly complain if then the Chief Minister seeks to justify his answer. Well, that's the way I understood with respect. Well, no, the way I understood the line of debate, and I hope I've understood it correctly, it is the Honourable Leader of the Opposition who then says it must mean either this or that. But then if the Leader of the Opposition invites a conclusion, with respect, he must be willing to listen to the conclusion. The Honourable the Chief Minister.
Well, Mr. Speaker, there are also two potential conclusions from his position. Let me just put it this way, because the Honourable Gentleman has wanted to open up the debate. I don't believe that there is any bitterness on this side of the House. Because, look, we won the election. There's actually a lot of happiness on this side of the House, because we are now able to implement the manifesto that we think is best for Gibraltar. That manifesto, Mr. Speaker, I believe, is never going to result in £17,500 per week being spent on something that is still a building site in order for us to be able to operate something there for the benefit of our electoral success, as the Honourable Gentleman tried to do down at the airport. But let's be very clear. It's not just that I'm saying £122,000 in 7 weeks. £17,500 a week was spent. And he says, because he recognises, Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Gentleman recognises, that this is a massive political hook onto which he has hooked himself by asking this question. It's a massive political negligence that he allowed, if he wasn't responsible for the cleaning contract, to happen under his watch. But there is an even bigger sign that he was responsible for massive overspends that have cost the community. I think he used to laugh during the election campaign when I turned up at debates with my battered copy of the Chronicle, when he first announced the terminal at £24 million, only to confirm just before the election that it came in at €80 million. €80 million, not £24 million, Mr. Speaker. The change, the order of magnitude of the increased costs is such, Mr. Speaker, anybody listening might be prepared to accept that the person who allowed a contract to build a terminal to slip from £24 million to €80 million is exactly the sort of Chief Minister that might have allowed cleaning for £17,500 a week, £122,000 in 7 weeks, in order to be able to operate his building site terminal in time for the election and show it off. But Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Gentleman then says that he wants to talk about the problems that people have experienced in developments under the previous GSLP administration compared to the absence of any problems whatsoever in his developments. You know, I thought he was actually connected to what was happening. But it became such an ivory tower, clearly, in Convent Place, that he didn't hear from what he tells us. There are many complaints of the good people at Cumberland Terraces that are coming to us even now to ask us to fix their homes. The complaints of the good people at Waterport Terraces who have problems in their homes. The complaints of the people in the Flat Bastion development that they did. The complaints of the elderly people in Bishop Caneja House. Look, Mr. Speaker, I take it from him, although he hasn't said it, but it's implicit in what every government does, that when a government builds, it wants to build to the best quality. And if there are problems, it's not because any chief minister or any minister has wanted there to be water ingress or has wanted there to be a problem. But he believes, Mr. Speaker, that he's entitled to say of others that they were negligent. But when someone raises the fact that even in the projects that he was in government for the development of, there are problems, he doesn't like to hear it. Well, Mr. Speaker, you know what? I think you're absolutely right. There's no point calling each other nervous jack-in-the-boxes or anything else. We're here to debate in order to give people the information that they're entitled to have from its government and which they are paid to elicit in questions, and when it's appropriate to provide it, we provide it. We're not here to call each other names, but that's the politics of the gentleman opposite, and I'm grateful for your rulings, and I hope that we'll therefore, both of us, be able to stick to the business at hand.
The Honourable Daniel Peaton.
Yes. Can the Honourable, the Chief Minister, confirm that it's taken him 7 weeks, or is it longer, for him to find out that there was this outrageous cleaning contract that had been entered into by JBS?
Mr. Speaker, I think that the Honourable Gentleman obviously wasn't listening to the debate, and he decided that he wanted to intervene because he needs to be relevant on the opposite side. If he looks back at my answer, he'll see when we identified this contract and the fact that it changed as from the 9th of January 2012 means that we would have identified the problem sooner. 9th of January, 9th of December is 4 weeks, not seven. And as he can understand, it's not always immediately possible to get all the information that one needs. He may be very interested to know that when one arrives at Convent Place, having been newly elected as a chief minister, an experience that he hasn't enjoyed, well, at least not yet. I know he's very keen to have a go. One doesn't have a list of all the contracts and what they cost so that one can quickly identify which to stop.
The Honourable, the Chief Minister, is unduly spiky. I asked a very, very simple question. And he's gone on this tirade of very subtle insults for which he is an expert. But let me just put this to him. If it's taken the government 4 weeks to identify this outrageous contract, cleaning contract that JBS has entered into. Does he not think that it's not unreasonable for a government, bearing in mind that the airport terminal opened on the 25th or the 26th of November, the general election was on the 8th, so we're talking about 2 weeks, that in fact, my honourable friend, the Leader of the Opposition, may well be right, that he didn't know and he didn't identify that there was an outrageous cleaning contract entered into by JBS during that 2 week period of time, the same way as it's taken the honourable gentleman 4 weeks in which to identify that it exists.
Mr. Speaker, I don't consider that ambition is an insult. So if I'm accusing the Honourable Gentleman of being ambitious of leading our community, I'm not considered that I'm insulting him. But you take it as you wish. In order not to appear too spiky, Mr. Speaker, and in order not to offend in any way, I'll just answer his question in a very simple way. No, Mr. Speaker, I don't agree. That the person who was there and who ordered the opening of the terminal could not have known what this was going to cost. On the point of order, the Honourable Gentleman is saying from a sedentary position that it is implicit in what I'm saying that he is lying. Mr. Speaker, as the Honourable Gentleman knows, parliamentary language requires never to say that one or the other is lying and to put a motion. It is very often implicit in the things that we say that we don't believe each other, and he spent the 8 years that I was sitting over there more or less telling me that and sometimes going over the edge and saying I was lying and then withdrawing it or never bringing the motion that he promised to bring. Mr. Speaker, I don't mind saying that I do not believe him, but I don't believe that that puts me in a position where I'm making unparliamentary remarks.
Well, I wasn't going to rule on it because I am not entitled to take into account remarks made from sedentary positions. So.
Yeah.
Next question.
Question 226.
I did not know.
Nor am I accepting his interpretation of facts and figures.
Question 226. The Honourable P.R. Caruana. 226.
Mr. Speaker, can the Chief Minister confirm that the design of Gibraltar postage stamps bearing the effigy of Her Majesty the Queen require the prior approval of Her Majesty obtained via the Convent and the Foreign and Commonwealth Office?
Answer the Honourable the Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, yes, that is correct.
Mr. Speaker, and is the Honourable Member aware that in respect of a postage stamp issue, a proposed postage stamp issue, that has obtained a degree of coverage and notoriety in the press relating to the appearance on a joint stamp issue with the State of Israel, including a representation of the Tower of David in Jerusalem, that the Foreign and Commonwealth Office indicated that the palace's consent to that design would not be forthcoming.
Mr. Speaker, yes, and I'll go further. I have seen a letter from the Foreign and Commonwealth Office, from their offices across the road from where he used to sit and I sit now, expressing that in terms which I think merited the reply that he caused to be sent.
And that therefore, implicit in that, very helpful answer for which I'm grateful to him, is that anybody who may, any correspondent to the Gibraltar Chronicle, that may, in ignorance of the facts, mischievously wish to create the impression that the refusal to proceed with the aforesaid issue, with the aforesaid depiction of the Tower of David, was somehow the policy decision of the government of Gibraltar, would be mistaken.
This is not an issue which there needs to be a party political difference. I agree.
Obliged to the Honourable Member.
Question 227, the Honourable P.R. Caruana.
Mr. Speaker, can the Chief Minister provide a list of 1, the civil servants, 2, GDC employees, 3, statutory agency and authority employees, and government company employees that have, since the 9th of December 2011, been transferred from the post that they occupied on the 8th of December 2011
giving a breakdown by entity, employee, post-occupied on the 8th of December, and post-transferred to.
Answer the Honourable the Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I now hand the Honourable Gentleman a schedule with a list of civil servants and GDC employees that have been transferred. I think the Honourable Gentleman will find that most of the moves are actually because whole departments have changed nomenclature and perhaps changed office.
Mr. Speaker, I'm not going to detain the House by trying to analyse this list now and asking supplementaries based on it, but can you just assist me by telling me whether all the information sought in the question is provided? In other words, civil servants, GDC employees, statutory agency and authority employees, and government company employees. I don't see... At first blush, the nomenclature on the columns appear to relate to civil servants.
Speaker, I think there is something else I should have said, which is that it's been confirmed by the relevant statutory agencies and authorities and government companies that no transfers of employees have been effected since the 9th of December 2012, although there was a discussion about a post having been abolished, I think, yesterday.
Mr. Speaker, in relation to GDC employees, is the Honourable Member confident that the answer that he's given me is correct? There are no GDC employees. I don't think this is controversial information. That there are no GDC employees, for example, that have transferred to ministerial officers, as is perfectly legitimate. But.
Mr. Speaker, that's the information I have been provided, and I assume that it is correct. I mean, I don't have control of this information.
Question 2. Question 228, the Honourable P.R. Caruana.
Mr. Speaker, can the Chief Minister say whether the government will agree to take part in, let me see if I pronounce this correctly, quadripartite talks with the governments of the United Kingdom, Spain, and another non-national tier of government in Spain.
Answer the Honourable the Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, no, sir.
Mr. Speaker, that is a position in which the government has and will continue to have the opposition's support. Is the Honourable Member aware that it has been an aspiration amongst parties in Spain for some time now, certainly before the 8th of December, to alter the architecture of the trilateral forum to make it non-trilateral. And does he share the view which underpinned our holding the position which he has now described also to be theirs, and does he hold it perhaps for the same reason, that to have symmetry on a quadripartite basis, whereby the Gibraltar position and status is made symmetrical to the position of some regional or local Spanish entity, is to downgrade the status of Gibraltar to a position that would not be compatible with our international political rights and aspirations?
Mr. Speaker, yes, sir, and I think I've expressed that when I've been asked questions in the media since then. Sometimes those in the media who ask the question and wish a positive answer don't print the whole answer that one gives when it's in the negative. But I think that in this House we are agreed on this issue.
Question 229, the Honourable Pierre Caruana.
Mr. Speaker, can the Chief Minister say whether he or anyone else on behalf of the Gibraltar Government has submitted views or information in response to the United Kingdom's current Overseas Territories Review?
Answer the Honourable the Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I can confirm that on behalf of Her Majesty's Government of Gibraltar, I wrote to Ms. Jessica Irvin, the head of the Iberian team at the FCO, setting out a detailed response to the UK Government's current Overseas Territories Review.
Mr. Speaker, and in the spirit of openness and transparency, which he continually reminds us informs his approach to government, is he willing to lay that document in the table of this House?
Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Gentleman will know that when I've asked him to disclose correspondence that he's had with the Foreign Secretary or with others, he's always said that he was inclined not to. And I am inclined to think that that was actually correct in respect of sharing information across the floor of the House. He's talked about laying on the table, which would in any event make the information public. I'm quite happy to discuss with him what we said, but not lay it on the table. He'll know that a lot of the issues were the issues that he and I have had an opportunity to talk about, and which I think both of us agree should not necessarily be the issues that we ventilate across the floor of the House.
Mr. Speaker, does the Honourable Member acknowledge that he cannot at one at the same time to say that he is better than we were in government at transparency and accountability, and then continually deny providing information on the basis that we used not to do it? Clearly he thinks that we were worse than him. If he's no better than us, then we are no worse than him. Now, he can, of course, legitimately take the view, which I wasn't seeking to dismiss as a possibility, not knowing the nature of the content of the document. He can, of course, take the view that it is inappropriate, quite so recently after it was sent, to make public interministerial correspondence, and that might be, depending on the content of it, a perfectly sound judgment on his part. But given that this letter must reflect the views, the policy of this government, which may indeed coincide with ours, and I'd be surprised if it didn't on many, if not most, issues. But given that, in effect, that letter contains a statement of the government's policies on important constitutional bilateral relationship issues, does he not think that it's not really a confidential exchange of correspondence, but rather a communication by the government of Gibraltar to the government of the United Kingdom of the policy position of the Gibraltar government on a constitutional matter, which would make it, I think, legitimate to table in Parliament? And further, even if I can't persuade him of that view, does he not consider that indeed the UK government may publish it? Because, I mean, the UK government has, as you know, there are cabinet office directives about the publication of things submitted to the UK government in response to consultation papers, which I believe are that the responses to government consultation processes are published, and that he may find that the UK government will publish his letter, treating it not as a confidential exchange of correspondence, but as a response to a consultation process. And in those circumstances, wouldn't it be better for him to table it himself as his own parliamentary act?
Mr. Speaker, let me start by saying that I don't accept that we are taking the same attitude to disclosure that the Honourable Gentleman took when he was here. The fact that I've equated one item, requested disclosure, to that attitude which he took doesn't necessarily mean that I accept that we are as bad as they were, but it's nice to know that he accepts that they were bad, Mr. Speaker. The position clearly is that we are trying to provide as much disclosure as is possible of all government information because government belongs to people. But, Mr. Speaker, that's one thing. Another thing is that we should be laying on the table and making publicly available every document that the government creates and which we have cause to send to the Foreign and Commonwealth Office on these issues. I am not saying that we're not going to make it available. I'm saying that at this stage, I think it's not right that it should become available. If it is going to become available in the United Kingdom as a result of cabinet directives or as a result of the consultation process being opened, in surprise as I might be that that is going to be the case, then certainly we would take the attitude that we should make it available as soon as possible to our people. I'm not advised that that is the position at the moment. I'm fully aware of Cabinet Office directives in respect of disclosure in the UK, which are very informative. Unfortunately, they don't lead to disclosure of documents and notes made about conversations that people may have had with ministers about 10 years ago, which I am very interested in seeing when they become publicly available.
That Parliament becomes aggressive. I couldn't have asked a more innocuous set of questions in a less aggressive fashion, and he just couldn't resist the temptation to make insinuative allegations which have absolutely no connection, and he does this continually. In Spain, there is a phrase to describe the Honourable Member, "Este tira la piedra y esconde la mano."
Although I don't recognise the accusation made by the Honourable Gentleman, I provided an answer in respect of communications with the Foreign and Commonwealth Office. I know that he didn't like it, but look, Parliament is also about a bit of spice, isn't it?
Whether you get nasty and then accuse others of getting nasty.
Mr. Speaker, I know that the Honourable Gentleman is saying that there are issues about being nasty. I don't think there's anything nasty about my saying that I want to see notes of conversations that happened 10 years ago. And the Honourable Member thinks that there is something nasty about that. It may be because he thinks that there's something nasty in the notes.
Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Member may think that everybody that listens to him is as thick as two short planks. But they are not as thick as two short planks. And there cannot be anybody listening to this debate who hasn't understood him to imply that he thinks that there might be things recorded in telephone conversations between me and Peter Hain which are not consistent with the things that I have said publicly. That is what he had in his mind. That is what he meant. It had nothing to do with what we were discussing. It is completely accusatorial and out of tone with the conversation that we were having and is monumental to his attitude in this House, which is he lights the fuse, and when the bomb explodes and people react, then he accuses the reactors of being unpleasant, aggressive, and wanting to convert Parliament into a fracas. He is, in that respect, the causer of much of the aggression that results in this Parliament, except that he hasn't got the courage to admit to it and always tries to be the nice guy, even when he's not the nice guy.
Mr. Speaker, I don't think there was a question there. I think it was an accusation. At least it's true that the Honourable Gentleman can never hide aggression. The Honourable Gentleman has never been accused of being a nice guy, and we all know exactly what sort of parliamentary performer he is.
Question 230, the Honourable P.R. Caruana.
Mr. Speaker, can the Chief Minister say whether the government is implementing the latest lands agreement with the MOD? And I promise him that I'm not on commission from the MOD on this question.
Answer the Honourable the Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, yes, sir.
And has the government yet had the opportunity to decide whether in respect to the various properties that are coming across at different intervals of time, which you may now be familiar with, whether it's the government's intention to put those out for sale, which is how
when we the government did the deal, it was envisaged that the quid pro quo, the reprovisions, would be funded.
Mr. Speaker, in fact, two residential properties transferred to HMGOG from MOD have already been advertised for tender, as the Honourable Gentleman may have seen. Other properties will follow in the next few months, and the GOG will shortly proceed to invite applications for the appointment of a project manager and designer for some of the works that have to be done, which will be financed through those sales. But I think the Honourable Gentleman will know that it is necessary to ensure that the properties which come over and which are put out to tender achieve certain prices in order to enable the funding of the works to occur. And he will also know that there are, in respect of very few of them, a call by some worthy organisations locally to use one or two for a particular purpose. So they may not all go out, or the residential properties may not all go out to tender in the analysis that we've seen. And if the Honourable Gentleman seems quizzical about that, there is, for example, one particular property which is being used for a purpose by the RGP, or was used by, for a particular purpose by the GDP, that the RGP may want to use that property for.
But not properties that are being cut. Residential properties are all being sold. I don't recall any conflict of demand for residential properties. Certainly there are non-residential properties that people have asked to have use of. But he may be right. I just don't recall that any residential property is being competed for a non-residential use.
Well, Mr. Speaker, I think there is one, maybe two, for a residential use. In other words, to put people for a period of time who need to be put there for a period of time by an organisation. But, I mean, it's really a very minor one or two. I think there was a letter for him, I think, during the period of the campaign, although it seems to suggest there'd been a discussion earlier about one or two of these properties.
Question 231, the Honourable P.R. Caruana.
Mr. Speaker, can the Chief Minister say who issued the invitations to the recent ceremony for the unveiling of a plaque in the lobby of Parliament to the memory of Gibraltar security police officers who died in a wartime explosion in Tangiers? And if I could just be permitted to add, by way of comment before the Honourable Member answers, that since giving notice of this question, I have received an entirely satisfactory apology from the Superintendent of the Gibraltar Defence Police, which I intend to accept. So the purpose of the question, I think the question still has a purpose, which is not that.
Mr. Speaker, I believe it was done by the Superintendent of the Gibraltar Defence Police. The Majesty's Government of Gibraltar had no involvement whatsoever. If it's of any assistance, I think the Honourable Gentleman was right to point out publicly that his failure to attend was not intended by him or his party as any slight to the people who were being honoured, and arose in the circumstances that he's already explained.
Yes, Mr. Speaker, of course, people are normally, and would normally, and should indeed normally be free to invite or not invite members of the government or members of the opposition, as the case might be, to their events. And certainly the opposition claims no right to be invited to things in and around Gibraltar. That is entirely a matter in the gift and sentiment of the host of the event. It arises only on this occasion, would he agree with me, because the erection of that plaque is the erection of a plaque in the precincts of Parliament. And therefore, it being something that Parliament, through the Speaker, gave its agreement to do. And would the Honourable Member agree with me that to avoid the possibility of such repetition of any such inappropriateness in the future, that the House ought to consider the rule that if anybody is going to host an event within the precincts of Parliament, the invitation list should be submitted in advance to the Speaker for him to consider whether, given that it is an event taking place in the precincts of Parliament, the Speaker considers that any issue arises as to inclusions or exclusions from the list.
Mr. Speaker, I have absolutely no difficulty with that suggestion. In fact, the Honourable Gentleman will know, and I think it is right to disclose, that you consulted both with him and with me about whether it was appropriate to have such a plaque in this place. And I, if I may say so, I think with respect that was absolutely the right position for you to take. And that therefore, it was a surprise to me that he wasn't there when the time came for me to say a few words. I think that this occasion is the only occasion I can recall of an event being organized there by anybody other than the mayor's office, who are as good at ensuring that the people who need to be in the lobby are invited. But I would have no difficulty whatsoever with what the Honourable Gentleman has suggested being the case in future in respect of any event to be organised in this place. This place is the Parliament, and despite our separate responsibilities in it and what our roles are, we are all members of it.
Question 232, the Honourable P.R. Caruana.
Speaker, can the Chief Minister provide a list of the persons other than ministers and officials of the United Kingdom government with whom he met during his visit to the United Kingdom between the 22nd of January and the 27th of January 2012, Sunday to Friday, and state the purpose and subject matter of those proceedings, of those meetings?
Answer, the Honourable the Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I now hand the Honourable Member a schedule with the information requested. He should note that in respect of the third entry, there's been a spelling mistake where it says cultural. It should say Gibraltar. And I think you'll recognise
Yes, Mr. Speaker, seeing the list of people that the Honourable Member saw has reminded me to do something that I had meant to do at the beginning of today's sitting but forgot, which is to acknowledge the sad passing of Mr. Joe Gallero, which I'm sure everybody in the House will wish to join. He has been a leading citizen and businessman in this community, and I'm sure the whole House will wish to extend its condolences to his family. Would you wish to associate with that before I proceed?
Mr. Speaker, yes, when I used to do that, he used to tell me that I should allow him to do it, but I'm very happy for him to do so, because I think Joe Gargero merits that sort of mention. It is absolutely right that we should remember today the contribution that he has made to Gibraltar life at every level, in particular in his entrepreneurial flair to Gibraltar's business life and how Gibraltar has been developed from the days when Mr. Gallego might have started in business during or just before the Second World War to the Gibraltar that he leaves today. So I fully associate myself and my government with those words.
Mr. Speaker, can you confirm whether Mr. Michael Beloff, the visit to Mr. Michael Beloff, it's down here as a courtesy, but I can't imagine that busy QCs do only courtesy calls. Is Mr. Beloff advising the government on any particular legal issue?
Mr. Beloff asked to see me because I was in London to pay me the courtesy of a call as a result of my being elected. I understand he advised his government at some stage, but as I understand it, he's not presently advising the government in any respect that I have been informed of.
And I hope and expect that his visit with Mr. Mittman touched upon possible sources of finance for another project that we discussed earlier, that they were interested in possible financing of power stations and things of that sort.
Mr. Speaker, in fact, he would find that Mr. Mittman wrote to me after the election to say that financing in respect of that particular project was an issue that had been discussed, and if I was next in London, would I like to see him in respect of that or any future potential financing opportunities? I took the opportunity of meeting the man to say hello, and so therefore, yes.
Mr. Speaker, is the Honourable Member able to identify in generic terms, because I think I know what it is, the name sounds familiar, the Harvey Golding Architects proposed project. Is that one that requires a very significant amount of landscaping of an area around the centre of Gibraltar?
No, Mr. Speaker, but I'm quite happy to tell him what it is.
Yeah.
Which is an area that would require a lot of landscaping to the south of Gibraltar.
Well, it depends where we've got central.
Well,
south.
Yes, I mean, in the area of the Alameda Gardens.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, that's the
central, right?
Yes.
So that's something that we had considered and. Okay. Mr. Speaker, I will privately have a word with him about the third item on the list, in case it has anything to do with a proposal that was once put to us. But I won't do it across the floor of the House.
And with that, we come to the end of answers to all the questions.
Can I just give the following indication to the Honourable Member, apropos a subject that we were discussing recently between us? If he wants to adjourn the House on this occasion to take legislation, I haven't checked on the agenda what's the first date that he can take the first bill, but if that date is more than 5 days from today, would be happy to confirm that he can safely do that without any danger that we might put down further questions.
Mr. Speaker, that's very helpful, but in any event, it's not necessary on this occasion. I'm grateful for the indication for the future.
Answers to written questions.
Mr. Speaker, I have the honour to table the answer to written questions number W59 to W70 of 2012 inclusive. Mr. Speaker, I have the honour to move that this House do now adjourn sine die.
I now propose a question, which is that this House do now adjourn sine die. I now put the question, which is that this House do now adjourn sine die. Those in favour?
Aye.
Those against? Passed. This House will now adjourn sine die.